Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is the day before Thanksgiving 2017. It is November the 22nd. I'm Nick. Here is Chris. And to all of you people out there who are outside the U.S. or don't celebrate Thanksgiving or are in Canada where it's celebrated on a different day, I say whatever. I don't care.
Yeah. Fuck you, America. Boxing Day, whatever nonsense holidays you have. Did you assume as a kid that Boxing Day was a day about boxing thing, like putting things into boxes and stuff like that, or that it was a day to celebrate the sport of boxing?
I remember the first time I ever heard about it was from a Foxtrot comic strip where Jason basically like uses some sort of like punching glove trap thing or something like that. And is like, yeah, this is what Boxing Day is. So I knew that that wasn't it. But when I saw that, I was like, well, then what the fuck is Boxing Day? Although when I first read that, I was like 10. So I was like, golly gee willikers, what in the whiz is Boxing Day?
I'm trying to comprehend what's funnier to me, that 10-year-old Nick has the same voice as adult Nick. Like, Mom, I want to go outside and play basketball. Or that 10-year-old Nick had an absurdly high-pitched voice. Like, Mom, what's going on? And then just one day on a hard turn, it was like, hey, Mom, what's up? We got soup tonight?
Well, I mean, I think that puberty hit me really, really hard in the vocal cords. I'll just let you guys know that. So I've had this same voice for a really long time, but before puberty, I sounded just like any other freaking kid. So, so I guess Boxing Day is not about the sport of boxing. And I kind of figured that from the very first day that I heard about it, but. It took me a long time to actually learn what it actually was. So.
I want to, because I'm tired of buying calendars that have December 25th and then December 26th, Boxing Day, in parentheses, Canada. Fuck that shit. We're making our own Boxing Day. It's going to be like National Talk Like a Pirate Day, and everyone walks around in old boxing gear, and you just start fist fights with people over nothing. And it's a very fun holiday, except...
Everyone's got to wear handlebar mustaches.
Yeah.
And, say, what-ho, you scoundrel!
You call people palookas. Palooka's like the word of the day, and you just have a ton of fun. Unless you bruise easily, then it's a bad day for you. Or if you have a glass jaw, you're out pretty quickly. It's the day you stay in. Don't order food either, because the delivery driver still counts. He's still like, what for, bam?
I mean, if it's supposed to be, you know, like a British in origin, then yeah, you know, just go all the way with it. You know, like, you have offended my lady.
Tally-ho!
For this offense, thou shalt be punished with a thrashing most heinous.
Pip, pip.
Let's go between, like, five different eras of British history.
None of them accurate.
At all. This sounds way more fun. Okay. Before we get into our regular manga, I believe there's an elephant in the room that we need to, at the very least, address. I don't think that we're going to spend a lot of time on this, because it's quite a bummer. But Nobuhiro Watsuki, the mangaka behind such series as Rurouni Kenshin, turns out he had kitty porn. It's a bad thing. That's not good. I've seen a lot of people having reactions to this, basically saying like, wow, I just found out that, you know, one of my inspirations as a creator or artist or writer, is into something really gross and illegal and bad. That sucks. And, it's going to put a lot of what we know about the stuff that he made in a different light, from now on. I've talked a couple of different times when we have more general discussions about stuff, because I haven't read all of Rurouni Kenshin, but I've read all of Busurenkin, and it was one of my favorite series for quite a while. And knowing that the guy who made it, it's kind of fucked up. It's going to take a little bit to probably come to terms with how I feel about the series now that I know that. It's really difficult nowadays to separate what you know about someone versus what you take from their work. And this has been kind of the year where a lot of famous people stuff is coming out of the woodwork in terms of sexual offenses that they've committed and gotten away with. Up until this point. it's a good thing that this stuff is coming out, not in the sense that now, you know, it's like, oh, we have to deal with that knowledge, but in the sense that, well, us knowing about this stuff is going to hopefully prevent people from being able to get away with this kind of stuff in the future, because people, they're going to be more afraid that people are going to be willing to speak out about it and are going to make them be punished for their crimes. But for the time being and in a very, very, very small scope, it's going to be weird to get used to this information. People are also wondering, like, oh, well, if this came out, is there going to be stuff that comes out about, like, other stuff? Like, you know, people that Watsky has worked with in the past, for example. Who knows? I think that it's too early to be thinking about that kind of thing, honestly. And this is a podcast where we try to have fun and we try to entertain you guys as opposed to making you think about the negative kind of stuff. So fortunately, we don't cover any Watsky series on this show to begin with. Otherwise, that would make some stuff super freaking awkward. If something ends up, heaven forbid, coming out about, you know, any of the people that we more regularly talk about, we'll deal with it when it comes to that point. But for now, let's try and just have some fun. Let's talk about the series as we know them right now.
Yeah.
Good.
By the way, we're not going to have fun when it comes to Black Clover. I'm going to tell you ahead of time, Nick. I am dead serious. It is,
and that's
some,
the one we're finishing on.
It's some kind of prophecy. When Annalise is on, we get a great chapter. As soon as she's gone, the most dog shit, garbage, fucking trash tier chapter comes out.
Okay. We've got a couple of different series that we're not talking about this week, because One Piece is off, and because Crunchyroll didn't post the Seven Deadly Sins chapter, they're back to that. But we've got
so in 3 weeks' time, we'll have five chapters of Seven Deadly Sins to regale you with.
Like, where did these extra two come from?
They're just like a wormhole. What?
They were teleported into the future for some reason, as opposed to being updated on time. But we've got Astra and we've got Boruto, so it's probably going to be about the same, like, and unfortunately we've got to finish on Black Clover as opposed to One Piece. Wouldn't be a big deal if it were actually a good chapter. But anyway. All right. Let's kick things off by talking about My Hero Academia. So last time the chapter ended with, Chisaki being carted away in a, what do you call it? Paddy wagon? Or whatever, super armored police van vehicle thing. But there was a truck that had Shigaraki and Kuragiri and Dabi hanging on the back of it, with Shigaraki in the most dangerous position you could really be in while riding a truck.
Yeah.
So we picked things up from there in number 160 of My Hero Academia Expressway with, I guess this is kind of a flashback, I guess, to them getting the tip from Toga and Kuragiri's not there. It's not Kuragiri, it's Mr. Compress, my mistake. Mr. Compress, we see getting a tip from Toga about what direction Chisaki is being taken in. You know, of course, Toga says, like, oh, by the way, yeah, we didn't get the girl, unfortunately, but they've got their finished product with them, so should be good. Why are they transporting Chisaki in the same vehicle that they're transporting the stuff? Shouldn't they be taken away in, like, separate vehicles for safety?
There's only so many cars in the world, Nick. It's a world of superheroes, not a world of cars. That would be Transformers, and it would be a much different series.
This guy can disintegrate and reconstruct things at will, and you're going to just leave him with the stuff. I know that you've got him restrained, but what if he can somehow get out? Bad.
I assume that he's supposed to have the same power dampener stuff that they're using to keep All for One contained with. I don't remember if they explicitly stated. I know they have his like hands and like a manacle box of some kind, but
it won't be for long.
Yeah.
Outside of that, though,
spoilers, like, Nick. I only got 7 pages into this chapter. Everything turns out okay for Chisaki, right?
Oh, yeah, you know, he goes off and ends up actually being besties with Shigaraki. They walk off arm in arm, and while, you know, that one song, Me and You and Me, you know, plays in the background. Meanwhile, there's, like, people in, like, Smash Brothers plush costumes beating each other up in the background.
What a classic
that was
commercial.
A wonderful commercial. Um. So yeah, I'm just saying, like, are you sure that you've got this guy's entire organization taken out? Well, if you've got someone who's going to come and save him and the product, that's a bad idea transporting them for exactly this reason that happens. Anyway, we see, you know, Toga and, Jin twice are, you know, I guess they're supposed to be incognito. I think that that's the idea, because it took me several tries reading this to be like, why the hell did Twice take his mask off? Toga knows he freaks out when he doesn't have it on. Is she mad at him for some reason? Like, is it because he told her to do something and she was like, oh, don't tell me what to do? And then she took his mask off to make him suffer? But then I realized, like, oh, they're in civvies. So I guess that they're supposed to be incognito right now.
Is it really a civilian costume for Toga when her villain costume is just that with a Bane mask on?
No, her villain costume is her being naked, Chris.
I feel like she's always walking around a schoolgirl outfit or naked, so I feel like schoolgirl civvies aren't really the best thing. I feel like her real, like, civilian costume should be this elaborate supervillainous outfit or something like that. Everyone's just like, who's that?
No one will think that I'm the schoolgirl villain now.
That's not Toga. She only wears a schoolgirl outfit
or
nothing.
No, I'm not Toga. I'm not naked or wearing a schoolgirl uniform.
Yeah, but you have the Bane mask on. Yes, but I'm not wearing a schoolgirl outfit.
But I'm not schoolgirl Bane.
Yeah. I'm just Empress of Tomorrow Bane.
Also, apparently Mr. Compress is super comfortable with only having one hand now because he's making jokes about it. He's totally fine with it.
Yeah. I mean, come on. That was like fucking like a week ago.
A week ago.
Get over it, dude.
Oh boy. So, we cut away from them to where the action actually is. It's the Shigaraki's team has opened the van up. We see that, yes, Spinner actually is the guy who was driving. So I guess he wasn't ever captured or killed or anything like that.
I was going to say, like, I thought the only ones they captured were the ones they actively outright beat. Like, I know Moonfish and the Muscle Guy got captured, but I didn't think they got anyone else.
I guess it's just because Spinner is probably like the most forgettable guy in the entire league right now.
His like quirk, from what I understand, is just looking like a lizard and a weapon. Yeah, but I knew I was like, I feel like I've seen him around since then.
Also, I very much appreciate that Dobby has just the same name for him as we did, which is just the lizard guy.
I also like that he explains why his driving is so bad is because he only knows how to drive from video games. He's never driven before in his life. He's just like, all right, well, hold on, shit. Like, this isn't from a top-down perspective.
Well, I guess that, like, Shigaraki is like, okay, guys, so we need Mr. Compress to be in the back so we can complete the capture so he can't drive. Who here knows how to drive? And I was like, nah, I'm like 16. And Doug is like, no. And Jiro's like, I can drive! No, I can't. Yes, I can. Okay, we're not going to let him do it. I keep on failing my license exam because I disintegrate the wheel. Okay, fine, you can do it, Spinner.
Spinner, are you 16? Or How old are you? How do lizards age? He's like, this is very insensitive. And I'm 39, fuck you.
I'm 600.
Spinner the Timeless.
So the villains start to attack the police escorts around the van. Dobby launches his flames. They are combated by, I guess this guy is escorting them too? Because I don't see him come out of anywhere. I think he's actually in one of the cars or the van or something like that.
Oh, are you talking about Hulk Hogan Sandman? This is totally Hulk Hogan.
I never even considered that.
You will not convince me otherwise that this guy was not designed after Hulk Hogan. It's got the big mustache, the bandana, the long hair.
The hair that only comes out of the back, so he's probably bald underneath that bandana.
Yeah, 100% in my mind, this dude is Hulk Hogan.
It's the League of Villains, dude. The King of Monsters, the Grungiest Society, brother.
Listen here, there, Dobby.
He's the Sand Hero of Snatch. So they fight for a bit, Snatch is actually very effective against Shigaraki because he can't grip him effectively because he's made of sand, like the Sandman is. And Snatch actually like brags at him, you can't grab a sandstorm, dude! But fortunately, Mystica Press, it turns out in this chapter, has one of the coolest powers ever because, you know, the first time that we saw him, okay, he shrinks people down and captures them. That's a useful ability, sure. But he also can, as we'll find out later, compress not entire objects, and also he can use his decompression as a weapon. Because he just tosses a little ball out, it goes underneath one of the cars, and then turns into a boulder and launches up into the air.
He's essentially like...
He does this whole, like, flamboyant magician speech while he's doing it.
He's so dope doing it, and like, in my mind, I'm like, oh, this dude's like a fucking Pokemon master too. He's just like, I could choose you, Giant Rock!
Rock.
He's like, oh, I'm weak against rock.
Rock types? No rocks.
Just rocks. No one's weak against rock types. They suck.
No one's weak against rock. What are you talking about? Ice is weak against them. Bugs are weak against them. Flying is weak against them.
Yeah, but they're weak to everything else.
They are weak against a shit ton of stuff. Fighting, ground, steel.
Water. Grass.
Are they weak against grass? I know that ground is weak against grass.
Yeah, they're weak against grass, too.
Anyway, so it launches the car into the air. Also, Shigaraki was just on top of the car that he launches into the air, so he goes vaulting onto the van from... It's a freaking Mario game with this guy. Like, I know that he's got the disintegration stuff. Apparently, he has incredible physical aptitude and agility. But, yeah, he's doing it. Everything crashes, basically. Spinner just flat out says Grand Theft Auto while he puts the frickin' truck into a spin in order to stop it. Essentially they've beaten all of the cops and there's only Snatch left. He launches an attack, fights with Dobby for a little bit, and then Mr. Compress catches him and turns him into a little ball. They say something kind of weird, because Mr. Compress, says like, oh yeah, I got him, you know, sand doesn't burn. And Dobby says, looks like only his top half can turn into sand. He's probably dead.
I'm going to assume he's not dead. It would seem really weird to introduce this superhero, especially when you designed him based on Hulk Hogan, clearly. And then you just kill him in the same chapter. So I imagine he'll come back, but... Yeah, it was a little tough to understand exactly what was happening there.
Yes, because Dobby coated him in fire, and then just to make sure that they took him out, Mr. Compress shrank him down to disable him. So they probably assumed that the fire got his lower half and burned him up and killed him.
I guess so. I'm not entirely certain.
Anyway, nothing else important happens in this chapter, so let's just take it easy.
Yep.
So the
control from here.
The prisoner van's been toppled over. They get inside it, drag out Chisaki, who is, you know, strapped into this like bed stretcher thing with in restraint to it. And Chisaki's like, "Are you gonna kill me?" And Shigaraki's like, "I thought of something even worse." And so Mr. Compress leans down and shrinks his arm. Which means that he turns just his arm into a ball, and he's got a stump at his elbow now. Well, that's horrifying. He can just touch you and turn you into... take off your limbs, holy fuck.
That's pretty fucked up, too. I love that like poetic justice of just like, I'm gonna take your arm. Because fuck you, that's why.
Also, I have an artificial arm. Thanks for that.
You got him robot arms.
And Chisaki doesn't even react to this. He just kind of goes,
hey.
Like, no noise.
Your nerves would still be, I was going to say, like, maybe it just doesn't hurt to do it. Like, you just,
well, he's not even like surprised.
Yeah. He's just like, what are you doing?
I guess for a guy who's like disintegrated and reconstructed his body a whole lot, that wouldn't be as much of a thing, but still, Shigaraki basically pockets the product, and this freaks out Chisaki far more. Because, like, give that back! Also, can you, like, put my arm back? That
Oh. Come on, dude. Dude, remember when we were buds? We had that one chess game that one time.
You know, I hated that chess game. You cheated. You just don't know how the rooks move.
Or the pawns. Weirdly, the one you got was the horse piece. Everything else you were so bad with, but you got the
called
L.
Knights. Shigaraki then starts to monologue a bit, and says, "Listen, Overhaul, a guy spouting off about getting rid of all quirks shouldn't be relying on quirks, right? Which is a good fucking point."
I do love it.
And he touches Chisaki's arm, which starts to disintegrate and crawl up from his hand. And, Shigaraki just says, "Let me slice that off for you unless you want it to fall to pieces." He just cuts his freaking arm off with a knife! That is a sharp goddamn knife!
I mean, I guess if it's all corroding, then maybe it's just like, it's like slicing through, like, something that would be easy to slice through. I'm trying to think. It wouldn't be like butter. Butter doesn't, like, crackle apart. Like a cracker. Maybe it's like slicing through a cracker.
Ugh. Chisaki declares that Shigaraki declares that Chisaki is now a useless, helpless, quirkless wonder. Which, I don't think he actually used any of the bullets on him. Maybe he knows that Chisaki has to actually, like, use his hands, I guess.
I'm guessing he's been able to figure out how his quirk works, and yeah, the implication seems to be that having hands is the way that he's actually able to apply his power. But I don't know, maybe there's still the potential that Chisaki can, I don't know, like, attach something to the end of his, like, he could even just use, like, the end of his arms or whatever to do it. I don't know. Although, I guess he's going to jail anyway, so who cares?
Yeah. Well, this is a very good way of saying, like, so, yeah, Chisaki's not going to really be able to do much from now on, so.
Yeah, we're not going to get a fucking My Hero Academia the movie fucking Overhaul Gold or whatever bullshit unless they really have to, like, try to work him in.
I mean, he might come back, but he's not going to be using his powers on anything anymore. Shigaraki then basically laughs in Chisaki's face, and says, "All that hard work you put in, it's mine now! Your life's gonna be a real nail biter now. Not that you've got nails left to bite. You should just sit back and watch. Have a nice life. Because this is our time."
It's our time! It's our time! That old DX song.
So, So the League of Villains poses for their album cover as they walk away from an explosion. They've stolen the quirk destroying bullets formula. They cut off Chisaki's hands and also seemingly killed a pro hero. League of Villains ain't none to fuck with. Holy shit.
Yeah, this is a pretty big chapter for them to look good, to look strong with. It was a pretty fucking dark chapter too, because it really is just fuck you, Chisaki. You are nothing now. I almost was hoping that he was going to be like, "Oh, I'm going to take these hands, just add them to this hand collection I have around me."
My hands have to come from somewhere, don't they?
Yeah. He's like, "Ooh, these are nice hands." Ooh. You're like, "Boss, you're getting kind of weird about this." But yeah, no, this is a great chapter for the villains to look strong, and it kind of feels really effective in that way, you know?
Yeah. It was okay, so Shigaraki turns out had a plan the whole time, and what a freaking plan it was. You can tell that he's kind of been stewing on this guy for a little bit, because that was an act of pure hatred right there that he committed, and he was so happy to dismember him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I had about 4 holy shit moments while I was reading this, so really good chapter. So,
it's the images, like the one with Shigaraki's like just hanging over him, taunting him, laughing about all that hard work and everything. That I'm like, this is the kind of thing, like, I know people love the My Hero Academia anime, but I'm like, it's shots like this that make me be like, it's just like, I feel like that's something you just can't capture, just how terrifying of an expression that is. Cause I feel like it would take so much work to like animate that much detail of that horrifying expression. It's also one of those things that I wish I could remember which like chapter it was so I could send it to my friends who watch the anime and be like, no, look at this shit.
I've been watching the anime dub with Nicole. Something that occurred to me as I was watching it, is that, wow, Shikaraki acted very childish, immature, and impatient, at the beginning of the series. And if you compare that to how he is now, like, he will childishly and cruelly get his revenge on somebody, but this is something where he had stuff go exactly the way he wanted it to after sitting on it and sitting back and waiting for his chance. So it's the thing at work with this series where, you know, the young characters learn over time, and that counts for the villains too. So, and that's one of the things that makes them so dangerous is that while their heroes are learning to get better, so are their villains.
Almost so that passes the torch makes for a great hero-villain dynamic relationship, doesn't it?
You won already. Shut up. Okay. Next, we're going to move on to Astra Lost in Space.
I didn't realize there was an Astra Lost in Space.
There was an Astra Lost in Space chapter, Chris. I said that at the top of the episode.
Let me very quickly suddenly read that. You go ahead.
Okay. So, this chapter of...
Holy shit, Kyotre is wearing a shirt! I said to react to the first thing I saw.
Kyotre has been caring for Kanata in between chapters. She says that he's doing okay. Apparently, she performed a medical procedure without anesthesia, and he was just like, yeah, all right! But he's basically fine now. Probably the part of this chapter that really caught me off guard the most is what Yun Hua says in this on this first page, which is, and his arm, and it's like, it went into a wormhole.
It's in space. She's like, yes,
it's gone.
But will he ever regain use of his fingers? It's in space.
Light years away.
But will he ever be whole again?
No. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, he will. You sweet summer baby, you.
Oh my god. Like, I know it's like an excuse to kind of, just in case you forgot, because this is what's happening. But holy shit, Yun Hua, no! People don't get their arms back. Those don't grow back, despite what WTN will tell you.
Despite what you... Just like, but I read Bleach! A lot of people were in the fourth division at one point!
I read so much shonen manga, it's not a big deal, right?
One of us has probably been in the fourth division at some point. Guys, raise your hand, fourth division, huh? Anybody? Char starts raising hands. You're like, put it down. You weren't in the fourth division.
There's a little bit of dialogue between Kyotre and Charis because obviously she, you know, kind of holds a little bit against him because of what the hell just happened. It's not kind of like I'm an angry with you thing so much as I'm gonna be upset with you about this because holy shit, Charis. You got our captain's arms sent into space thousands of light years away. And Yun Hua's like, that means it's fine, right?
If we get it on ice quickly enough, can it be retached?
It will be frozen!
It's plenty cold already. It's in space!
It will be frozen and boiling at the same time. Zach comes in with Paulina, and he reports that he actually replaced the parts that Charis removed when he first sabotaged the ship, but the communication system still doesn't work properly, which Paulina says is because most likely they have two halves of two different ships together and the communication systems between them are slightly different. So the parts that you replaced aren't actually going to do any good because it's in a different part of the ship. So it's like, okay, fair enough. What that basically boils down to is, okay, so we still have to actually fly home. this doesn't, we're not going to be able to fix the communication systems in wait here. And everyone's like, yeah, that's fine though. Whatever. We were just going to head back anyway. That doesn't really change stuff back. Charis, says to Zach, hey, you should lock me up in the brig, basically. When we get back to Astra, turn me into the police and, you know, have me tried for attempted murder along with all of our parents. But at that moment, Kanata comes in and he's like, nobody's gonna do that.
Is your arm okay? Shut up.
Kanata's like flexing his left arm. Yeah, it's fine. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, this thing's great. Ooh, look at me. I can do all sorts of stuff with it.
Kitori's like, lay down and rest. And he's like, nope. He says, no, because it hurts. And anyway, I was lonely all by myself. And he just, like, this is just so shonen protagonist of him, because he starts, like, immediately using his arm for various things, like pointing at people and stuff.
Charis, I need you to grab that drink over there. Which one? That one right there. There's several drinks there. You need to be more specific. That one,
bro,
right there.
Use your other. I haven't sent my arm into the depths of space. Okay, fine.
Use your other arm. No.
I don't know what Kanata is being such a bitch about. His arm's fine.
As it floats by in space.
It floats thousands of light years away to, like, flip her off through the window. Oh, boy. So, Kanata immediately takes charge again. He says, no, we're not locking Charis up because I say nothing is different from how things are. And we're going to need all hands on deck because I can't freaking do anything to help you guys out to gather supplies and stuff. We need people to help. I can't forage. We need you to make up for my lost ground. And if you want to eat, you've got to work. You can't just sit here and stew while we take care of you. And Olgar, you know, speaks up and he says, so you're telling us that we should trust him. And Kanata says, I trust him. Well, what if he pulls out the orb again? He's like, well, then you can take my left arm, too.
What a fucking badass little boast that is. And it's such a shonen attitude to take, but it's just like, when he pops up, then you can take my left arm, too. What about your right arm? It's still fine.
But Kanata brings up the point of, look, we've made it this far because we trusted each other. We can't stop now, even after this. You know, we can't make everything that we've gone through this far a lie. I say that everything is the same as it was, and anybody who has a problem with that can come see me. I'll take you along with just my left arm. So, yeah. But everyone's pretty much satisfied with that. Even Olgar said...
Yunwell walks up and uppercuts him. She's like, bam! I win! I can beat you with two arms!
Even Olgar says, like, hey, I was just, you know, asking for your opinion to clarify it. I'm not gonna, like, you know, hold it against him either. And Kitori kind of turns things around too, and she just says, hey, make sure that you make up for what happened with our captain, okay? And Charis is all tearful and apologetic and says, I was able to become myself thanks to you guys. I want to live as my own person now. I want to go home together with all of you. Aww. Kanata also clarifies, hey, you know, when we get back, you know more than any of us, so you're going to need to testify on that conspiracy and everything. And also, I've got some more questions I want to ask you, because as the son of, as you know, the clone of the king, you must have, you know, secrets about our world that you know about. And Charis is like, yes, and I'll tell you all of the truth that has been passed down in Vixia. And all of a sudden, Kanata collapses like, oh, not more monologuing narration, But actually, he's like, my arm hurts. And, you know, he's like, I thought it was fine.
Someone tell her to get off the ship. I can't deal with this. Not today.
I'll go get your arm. I'll be fine in space. Why didn't we just swim home like this?
Char, send me through the wormhole.
And Kitori's like, oh my god, of course your arm hurts, and you've suffered from so much blood loss, you idiot. Yes, you need to sit down and frickin' rest. Meanwhile, everyone's like, okay, let's go start foraging for supplies. And everyone's like, hey, yeah, yeah. including Kanata, who raises up his stump while everyone's raising their fists. I don't know if that's funny or disturbing, honestly. He's just like, yeah!
Go, team! They're like, this is the part that's lost the blood. Stop! Stop it!
It's so weird. Oh, God. So, we get a little bit of a montage where they spend 3 days just gathering supplies and stuff. Kanata's left in his bed playing, sleeping slash playing a really boring app that Zach came up with so he wouldn't be completely bored out of his mind. There is a quick scene between Kanata and Ares where they're like, oh, it's so beautiful out here. Let's stare at it and have a kind of romantic moment. Yay. But Ares also says, like, you know, I'm never going to gonna forget all of this, the view, the time we spent together. And Kanata's like, oh, yeah, you've got a photographic memory, so of course you would. No, that's not what I mean! But I think that this is Ares saying this. The narration around the panels, which says, despite that, a part of me wished our journey would keep going. The thought of it coming to an end made me the teensiest bit sad. I think that's supposed to be Ares talking.
Actually, that's from the viewpoint of a lone ant that's been smuggling aboard their ship. This has actually all been the journey from that ant's perspective.
Every single time that they've been foraging, he's been like, I gathered some sugar cubes, guys.
I'm helping. I like to consider that they think of me as a friend. Guys, that one ant's back! Kill it, kill it, kill it!
Oh, we have fun, don't we?
What a day.
It makes me think this little bit here is like, oh god, there better not be another freaking person trying to sabotage this trip, I swear to god. I'm getting kind of sick of that already. With the stuff with Olgar wanting to shoot Luca, with freaking Charis trying to kill them all the bullshit that they've been through besides that. Just get home, guys, please.
Get home and then deal with your awful, awful, quote-unquote, parents.
Yeah. And, yeah, 3 days pass. Everyone basically shoots off into hyperspace for the last leg of their journey. And they're like, yeah, we're going to get home. We're going to get to planet Astra. And now that everyone's settled in, they're going through hyperspace. They have a meeting with everyone, and Kanata says, all right, we're all here. And it's going to take us 19 days to reach Astra, which gives us plenty of time and then some. So are you ready to talk to us now about everything? And Charis says, yes, I'll let you know everything that I know about Astra's secrets.
Credits.
So more info dumping. Hooray. But at least we got a little bit of a reprieve from it with the action scene last chapter and this one. A little bit of a chance to kind of catch our breaths.
Yep.
So that's it for that chapter. It was very much kind of just, all right, we need a little bit of a break here. So here's a little bit of a jokey chapter while we kind of reset and establish how the dynamic is going to just stay mostly the same now. And who knows how many more chapters of backstory we're going to get in a row from here, because there was quite a bit that we got already.
I love the bits from Kanata, though. I love that he has that attitude. I don't know why. I love that boast of just like, hey, what if you use the rubber? Yeah, then you can take my freaking left arm, too. Like, I don't know. It's just a cool kind of speech for him. Like, yeah. Okay, it keeps the crew together.
Yeah. And it's nice to know that, you know, I mean, he was, it's the same as he was last chapter before the portal came out. You know, he was willing to overlook everything that Charis did because he sees Charis as a friend and a companion, stops him from trying to kill himself. Loses his arm and still is just like, no, he's my friend, he's our crew member, we need him. So, awesome conviction. Okay, we also got to talk about Boruto this week.
I have like one note about Boruto this week.
Okay.
It's that when they reveal, because this entire chapter is all about this scientific ninja tool academy, like, institute thing, and they're showing off all the cool stuff they have. So they're showing off that they have the fucking, like, wall climbing boots and everything like that. And it's like, yeah, they have this. And just to make sure that the ninja fucking scientific tool community is not behind on the fashion world, we have high-heeled versions of them for women as well. Sure. I was like, why? They're such like goofy, clunky-looking boots, but they still had the technological foresight to be like, let's make a high-heeled version of this for the 11-year-olds in our audience.
While we're on that subject, I actually want to bring up something about that in terms of Sarada's foot gear, because there was like an entire thing in early Naruto about like where they do this thing where it's like, oh, you know, you focus chakra on your feet so that you can use them to cling to surfaces and go up walls and trees and stuff. Wouldn't it be even more difficult for Sarada to do that because she has less surface area to apply that to with her heels?
Yeah. I guess if the notion was meant to be that it is applied evenly throughout the surface area, then she has to apply an even greater amount of precision across just that, like, base part of the top of her foot. Unless you can balance it through the heel and it... I don't know. Yeah.
It's impractical for yet another reason. It's stupid.
It seems really, really dumb to wear high heels into any kind of ninja combat, I guess is what
it's like. But I have to be the same height as my teammates.
I love heels. Like, I get it. Heels are great, but I feel like this isn't the time for them.
Oh, gosh. All right. So they go with Dr. Katasuke to the research academy thing. By the way, this is chapter 18 of Boruto, The Hand. And I'm going to make a reference to something here from a long time ago. When we were kids, Chris, did you ever see commercials for the Mighty Max playsets?
Describe a bit more. I know I played with Mighty Max. They used to be like things would be like shaped like a head and you'd open it up.
Yeah, it would be shaped like something gross and it would open it up and there'd be this whole like kind of evil lair or something like that that was, you know,
and I used to watch
Mighty Max going on his little adventures and stuff.
And I used to watch the Mighty Max TV show.
I watched a couple of episodes of it.
It wasn't good.
No.
Not good at all.
I remember his hat was important for some reason. Anyway. But yeah, the way that the commercials would go is, you would be like, Mighty Max, Mighty Max. And it'd be like, oh, you can go through the Mighty Max playset. Oh, no, 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 you know. There was one that was called The Hand. And so literally this comes up and I immediately go like back 20 something years and it's like, The Hand. What the fuck?
Like,
where
did
this memory come from?
It's back. See,
Mighty Max, The Hand. And that's just like what I remembered. I remember it was like a bony hand. That's all I remember about the commercial.
You know what's actually really good about this, though, Nick? And this is very important because I think a big part of kind of like dealing with big loss is kind of learning to get over it and to disassociate with it. That when you first read this, your first thought wasn't to be like, God, these fucking Netflix series in The Hand. Get over it. They suck.
Just have Madame Gao and no one else!
Stop with The Hand! They're not cool!
Now I am part of The Hand. I am there. No! No more people in The Hand!
I'm Nobu's twin. Oun. Why would they just make you like a weird anagram of his name? Our parents weren't creative.
Okay. Anyway, Boruto. So they go with Dr. Katasuke to the research development thing. They finished escorting him there. And everyone at the institute, this is like a recurring thing throughout the chapter, which is impressing upon Boruto what a good guy Katasuke is and how awesome his inventions are. Because Boruto has his own head up his ass about, you know, ninja science stuff, as established in the previous chapter, for some reason, despite cheating. However, the most off-putting thing for me in all of this is the introduction of someone who is, I guess, like interning or something like that at this institute, who is an old classmate from the Ninja Academy, Kakei Sumire. Now, I like that they established kind of open up the world of Naruto a little bit, which is like, hey, everyone goes through this like kiddie ninja training, but not everyone ends up going and becoming a ninja. Some of them go and do other shit. That's something that seems like should have been more firmly established a long time ago. I know that occasionally you would see stuff like the ninja science stuff in various points in the Naruto series, but it needed something along the lines more like, you know, My Hero Academia did, where, you know, it's like, there's this guy from the studies course, there's this person from the support course, you know. Not everyone actually is a hero who goes to this giant school.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. The most off-putting thing about all of this is the fact that Sumire just dresses like a regular frickin' schoolgirl. That's so strange to me, that, like, regular clothing exists in Naruto, and it conforms with the conventions of, like, modern-day Japan. Even more strange than, like, ninja tech, I guess.
I think it's really surprising and kind of sad that this girl had the poor, unfortunate situation to end up with the nickname Class Rep. That's not a nickname. That's title that you shortened. Like, it's just like, why do they call you Class Rep? I was the class representative. So it's not really a nickname so much as it is your position, and they just shortened it. Yeah, well, Boruto just wasn't good at nicknames.
Well, the thing is, though, that makes sense, actually, because it's like how people, after they graduate, will still use the terms senpai and kohai. It's just like something that they continue to do after they've progressed on from school a lot of the time.
It just seems weird calling it, like, referring to it as a nickname. Like, in my days, a nickname was something like, hey, Stinky Face, or something like that. Like, you were just like, yeah, yeah, that's Stinky Face is what they called me, or whatever, you know?
What was it? Excuse me.
Are we searching for something?
Yes.
Something important? I looked up the hand, by the way. I forgot how stupid that playset was. Really opened up to an odd area, an odd shaped thing. How did I entertain myself so much as a kid? Like, this is fucking, like, I'm looking at this now, and this is the most boring fucking thing on the planet.
What are you looking at?
The Mighty Max the Hand playset.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This is nothing.
So, anyway, we're also introduced to a woman who works at this research lab, Inuzuku Akita. And immediately I was like, huh. Kiba has, like, a frickin' scientist cousin or something like that, which is kind of weird. But it immediately comes into play during the same chapter, so it's like, oh, okay, that's why I established that right away. She's basically Hatsume from My Hero Academia. Like, that's the easiest shorthand I have for it. She's, you know, super enthusiastic about her inventions and stuff. Done. Boruto is immediately a surly motherfucker about stuff, because Akita and Katasuke are, like, talking about various things. Like, oh, yes, you could try, you know, altering the artificial, modifying the artificial nerves and stuff. The reaction lag bothers me. They're just talking intensely about the artificial hand that they've just gotten back to the research lab. And he says something along the lines of, there are issues with the actuator's chakra sensing. And she's like, oh, okay, yeah. And Boruto's like, chakra sensing? Yeah, right. What a poser. Now, two things. Number one, shut the fuck up. You're still a hypocritical asshole about all this technology thing. Fortunately, this chapter is about beating that out of his goddamn stupid brain. Secondly, what? You don't know what they're talking about, do you?
It would be like me listening in on like a medical conversation. She's like, sir, his pulmonary fucking ovaries or whatever have expanded to us. I was like trying to think of fucking clinical terms for the body, and ovaries is the first thing. His pulmonary ovaries have expanded. I'd be like, what a poser. Like, I don't know fucking shit about this conversation.
What the fuck is he talking about? He's such a goddamn stupid brat. Chakra sensing, yeah, right. What a poser. I'm gonna, like, print out this panel and, like, put it on my wall just to remember all the shitty things that Boruto is guilty of in the future when he becomes a better character eventually, hopefully.
Yeah.
What a weird line, even in a context. Oh, God. Anyway, Boruto's like, well, we complete the mission, so I'm going to leave you assholes. And immediately, Sumire is like, your mission's just getting started, though. He's like, what? And Sarada's like, yeah, this is what happens when you storm out of fucking mission briefings back a little shit instead of listening for the whole thing, because we've actually got to help with the testing of the scientific ninja tools before we can go. And Porto's like, I don't remember anything about that.
Man, that's the worst, right?
Okay. So basically they're having like a handicap match to test out a ninja tool, and Sarada gets the ninja tool to use, and Mitsuki and Boruto would take it wrong. And Boruto's like, hey, I'm gonna go all out from the beginning. Are you sure about this? And Sarada's like, yeah, come on, asshole. Let's do this shit. Fucking kill you. And Boruto's like, all right. And they go in after him. After her, I'm sorry. A little bit of hand-to-hand fighting. Boop-a-doop-a-doo. Mitsuki manages to use his snaky arm things to grab Sarada. And this really bothers me. Her body... What happens to her spine in this picture?
Oh, yeah. I guess I didn't look that close.
It's like she's bent over this way and twisting around. The best way I can describe it is she strikes a Liefeld pose, but the angle to view her pose is the wrong one. So it's like, you know, she twists around so you can see her chest and butt at the same time. But then it's like, now let's take a look at an alternate angle and how that would look from the side. It looks disturbing, doesn't it? Look, where are her ribs?
I guess I got distracted from that because I could not comprehend what happens afterwards. Like, Mitsuki grabs her and I guess it's like going to throw her to the ground, and she just like lands like a cat. And I was like, what did she do? Like,
she manages to catch herself instead of landing on her face, I guess.
Wouldn't it still really fucking hurt because he's slamming her to the ground?
I'm sure, because she's stunned. And that's why Barth is going in after
her. She's decided to support herself on these fucking high heels and shit. She's like, well, my ankles may have shattered, but at least I still make that cool clecky-clack sound every time I walk. Which I won't be doing a lot of now.
So, Boruto goes in to finish off Sarada. Little miniature scroll pops out, and boom, smoke and bright light, and Mitsuki and Boruto are like, aah! And when it clears, Sarada manages to get a kunai to both of their necks. And it's like, ah, I win. So they're like, all right, very, very good job using the smoke flash bomb. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, if anyone knows this. We saw something that was basically like this in Naruto, right? There's an equivalent to, like, a flash grenade that we've seen so far. Doesn't, like, Shikamaru use something when he fought Tsuyuya? Like, he used, like, a flash grenade thing to extend their shadows in order to catch them. So I don't know what's so special about this. I mean, I know that Mitsuki says, like, well, it dulls my infrared sensor and my low frequency hearing are down. Because you know how snakes are with their infrared sensors. But I swear that we've seen, like, something like this before anyway. So I don't know why this was, like, supposed to be super impressive. I guess combining them all into one single tool is nice, but I don't know. You could have led with something else, like the flying machine that they use later.
You're like, oh, we also invented lightsabers. Why didn't you lead with that?
They fill out all these various different tools, and Boruto the whole time is just like, whatever. Then there's like, but like the second tool that they do is like completely obliterating all sound in a way that makes no scientific sense whatsoever. It's not that they cast an overpowering sound over everything, but she explains it by saying, like, by colliding specific phases of sound waves, you can drown out any and all sound. Well, yes, but you would have to constantly modify them as the sounds change, wouldn't you?
What? Shut up. No, you don't. I'm a scientist.
Anyway, they have a super huge machine that can just deaden all sound, and then she's like, yeah, I mean, it's nice. We don't really have a practical purpose, especially because it's big and all. I guess it could help with stealth missions if you could carry it around, but also you can't communicate. Anyway, and Bart is like, whatever. Oh, there's more. And then they have to put on like these freaking like mitts and shoes that they can climb. And it's like, yeah, it's like using Gecko's feet and stuff. And Bart is like, you can just use chakra to climb up the wall though. And Mitsuki's like, well, yeah, but this way you don't have to expend chakra. Oh. Yeah.
Now I'm confused because I now see it and those aren't actually special high heel boots Sarada's wearing. She's just, I think those are her regular heels and I think she's just doing the chakra walk, which then I'm confused. Is she just bragging or I'm very confused as to what the point of this is. I feel like they're really undermining the whole sell on these fucking wall climbing boots by being like, but yeah, I mean, we could do this anyway. It just doesn't require.
Those are the exact same shoes she was wearing earlier, it looks like.
So I think it's just she's just walking up with the regular chakra wall climbing ability.
Maybe they were like, sorry, we don't have these in heels. And she's like, then I won't wear them.
She's like, then they're dead to me. Burn the rest. Boruto, give me those boots so I can burn them.
They eventually strap Boruto up into this, basically, like, we attached him to four different drones with a frame between them thing. And he's like, whoa, I'm flying! And so I was like, yeah, guess you don't really mind using technology now, do you? And then he immediately crashes into the wall. I was like, you deserve it!
He's like, no, technology's evil! Whee!
Then, like, you know, he has some bruises that have to get, that are, like, being scraped up, and he's like, I can't believe I was actually enjoying using technology. He's like, don't you like using video games? Like, no! Not anymore, because it's technology, and I only just learned that!
I mean, I'm gonna finish The Witcher 3, but then after that, I'm done. I hate technology then. Oh, wait, when does fucking The Witcher 4 come out? Alright, I'll play that, and then I'm done.
So she sprays him with something, and he's like, what's this? Is it technology? She's like, yeah, it, like, boosts one's innate healing powers, and it heals wounds, and it, like, even seals open cuts and gashes. I hate it!
It's like, get that devil tech away from me! Boruto, in my mind, is, like, the super hardcore Christian conservative in a world of, like, medical science, where he's just like, what is this stuff? It heals your body's ability to stave off infections? Why do we need this? In my day, we just dove into a pool of leeches!
Oh, boy. Oh, God. So, he asks Sumire about Kataske, and she's like, yeah, I look up to him and trust him, and I think that he's, and I respect him. I think he's great. And he actually, Boruto notices a little plaque on the wall, because, like, Kataske is a big deal at this institute. And there's a quote from him that says, in science, any and all things are pursued. Scientists, through such pursuits, exist to support every and all people. That's actually a really nice sentiment, I think. I think that's cool. That's what we're here for. We're here to help people. At that moment, Akita comes in. She's chasing a little doggy named Chimaru. And Chimaru's like, I am a dog. Woof, woof. Lick. Yay. Wag. And Boruto looks down and he's like, he has an evil technological prosthetic.
I'll rip it off and kill him. I better eat this dog quickly.
He's caught off guard by this. And then Akita goes into giving the backstory of the dog. He's like, see, this little guy is a Ninuzuka ninja dog. He lost his leg from an injury suffered during a mission. It was career ending. Even it was for a fighting dog. To me, it was plenty enough that he survived, but he just seemed so forlorn. And one day, Dr. Kataske contacted me, having heard the circumstances, and he said, let's construct him a leg that is worthy of a ninja dog. And it was after that that I became the doc's assistant. And today, Chimaru is even more energetic than before his injury. To give the powerless and those who have lost something precious a ray of hope that will return their smiles to their faces, I believe that's what Dr. Kataske considers to be science.
Now, like, I invented this lightsaber to help people.
Hold on. I think that this is all really good, and I like that we're seeing this. Okay, it turns out Kataske is actually a really nice guy. He just kind of got really enthusiastic with promoting his, you know, inventions and stuff during the tournament. That was a dick move, but he's actually, you know, got a good heart, and this is, everything is in the name of helping people out. That's cool. And I understand this is, you know, a really big emotional thing, and, you know, Barto's been through a lot while he's at this institute, and this is where he comes around after seeing the dog. I have a problem, though, with, like, oh, yeah, this guy has these prostheses all over his body and stuff, and, yeah, I guess he wouldn't really be able to live a normal life without them. I'll immediately put him out of my mind. What? A dog has the same thing!
Now I've learned!
Like, come on! Fucking... Is Al just ugly or something?
Barto's like, who's Al?
Same message from a cute little doggy to get it beaten through that thick fucking skull of his?
I mean, look, Nick, dogs are universal. You understand that shit. You can hand a dog to anybody. They'll be like, I feel bad for this.
No, you can't!
I mean, you don't, but you're inhuman. You're just
exactly.
You're just a grumbly man.
And if I saw my fellow grumbly man being able to get along and be a little bit less grumbly, I'd be like, oh, science is kind of nice sometimes. So like, what? That dog could be a little yappy bitch all the time? Fuck it. Science is evil.
I'm going to eat that dog. Nick, stop trying to eat him.
Barto's so fucking transparent about everything. It's like, I can only understand something if it applies directly to me, whether it's goofing around having fun, playing video games, or having a yappy dog be happy to see me. Old men freaking me out on the train, fuck them, they don't deserve to be happy, technology's evil. Ugh. Anyway. So... Barto's had his big breakthrough. Actually, maybe he hasn't yet. Because after this point, the last thing that happens before he has this whole, I guess that all this technology is cool, do a good job on my dad's artificial hand thing. The last thing that happens is the Katasuke hands him a goddamn lightsaber. It's just a lightsaber. Holy shit, it's a lightsaber.
There's the thing. I actually really like this. And this is something that I've kind of grown to as I've like aged in time. Where I recognize that when a series, you know, especially something like this, which is kind of like meant to be like the next generation of a universe moves forward, like it shouldn't follow ever. Like if I were younger, I'd probably be like, fucking lightsabers and Naruto stupid. Like, this is just dumb. They're about ninja tech. But now I'm like, it kind of is cool to see like technology is increasing in the world of Naruto. And as such, the mechanics of how that world's going to work and the technology they're going to use increase. Like I'm pretty cool with that. Like, I think it's going to be kind of exciting to see. So I like the idea, like, technology is really kind of becoming pervasive in the Naruto world. It is weird that this experience that's meant to teach Boruto that technology is this incredible thing that can be used to help people ends with him being like, a lightsaber! I can cut the shit out of so many people with this! Thanks, Doc! You're a good guy after all! Where's that dog?
He doesn't have to do with the doggy at all. Maybe it really was the sword. He's just like,
what technology I find cool and entertaining.
Yeah, exactly. He was just like, so the sword can make me do my cool things from the video game? I love it!
He does give a nice little speech about this, because like, hey, you know, that prosthetic hand you're making for my dad, it's a hand that protects the village and everyone in it, so make sure you do a good job and make it cool and amazing. It's a nice little sentiment, and it's a nice line. And it's like, okay, good, you finally came around, but geez, the journey that we went through to get here made you really seem like a little shit. Thank God this stretch of the manga is over. Maybe you'll actually be a little bit better from now on. And the last thing is that they get on a phone call with Naruto, and Naruto's like, Konohamaru is in danger because he was attacked on a mission, maybe. So your guys are the closest ones there. Go scope it out and wait for backup. And I'm like, oh no, Sasakibe might die.
Not Sasakibe!
Oh, and Shikamaru and Sai and Naruto are worried about that, like, oh, there's an enemy that might... Kara that might... Anyway.
So that was Boruto for this week.
Yeah.
I mean, I like showing
all
off...
All over the place on this one, honestly.
I like showing off the technology. I like kind of creating this idea of really showing where the world of Naruto has gone now after this generation kind of skip and things like that. And it's... it's been annoying to watch the process, but it's good Boruto is getting over this hatred of technology. I think it was still a weird character trait to give him. Like, I understand still being a little bit angry or jealous over the fact that he was essentially, like, roundly punished for trying to cheat using technology, but it still seems weird for him to have placed kind of this very unnecessary blame on technology for that, as opposed to his own shitty morals. And also, it is strange to, like, give, like, a complete 180 to the scientist guy. He definitely did not come across as a guy who was like, I'm doing this for the good of everyone. I really just care about giving little sad doggies a fourth leg so that they can live happy in that moment. But, you know, it's all fine. Like, that all essentially works to the greater good of everything. It is strange to me at the end.
I wonder if this is a consequence of the character having one function during the Boruto movie, and then them wanting to go in a different direction when they started the series proper.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it is. It's just an interesting thing. Like, it's a really hard 180 that sort of comes about. Not that I'm saying I hate it and they shouldn't have done it. I'm just saying it does come across as strange when the only thing we knew about him before was he was kind of insidious. And now it's like, he really just loves giving little sad animals happiness. Like, okay.
If you say so.
It is weird though at the end that they're just like, hey, like two of our ninjas just went missing. Let's send a local Jonin team out there to find and save him, like a leaderless Jonin team.
They're not. I think that they're Chunin. I don't even know if.
Oh yeah,
I don't even know if they're Chunin.
Yeah, I was gonna say sorry. Genin, I guess, is what they are. None of them passed the Chunin.
I don't think that they've been through the Chunin exam at this point. If they have, they've done it off screen. So
yeah, so it does seem weird. They're just like, let's just let a bunch of like Genin without a leader go and find out what's up with that group. I get it. Like, they're like, hey, all three of these kids are powerful. You know.
Well, he says, Naruto also gave them specific instructions, like, yeah, we need someone to get there as soon as possible. Don't engage anyone. Just, like, purely gather info because we have no idea what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
Danger. All right. Let's get on to Dr. Stone.
Z equals 13. No.
Am I missing? Food Wars.
We gotta get some food wars in your belly.
Yeah, I don't know. God, I don't actually have the regular order in front of me right now, so I'm kind of going off of memory, and it's always wrong, because I always forget one thing right near the beginning. Anywho, it's Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma, Chapter 240, Not Cute. I was right last time. Yay! It's not nearly as, you know, it's a thing to be proud of as, like, you just, like, getting honey mustard from nowhere, but, it's like, yeah, there was something in the middle of Megumi's Dorayaki. Hooray. It's enough to get the male judges to envision themselves with their shirts stripped off. So like, and they're like, ah, there is something in the middle there. There is an apple confiture in the filling right here. And Megumi gives this big, long explanation about this. And she, at the end of it, she says, like, see, there's a difference in the flavors, the contrast they create between them. That's the last and biggest trump card in my dish. And so I was like, whoa, with both the fillings, you know, they look similar, but the difference in their flavors comes as a completely unexpected surprise. And Hisako recaps, like, you know, it's kind of like what Aldina's pizza did, be, you know, with the two different halves. But this time, you know, it's in the center rather than being divided between the two halves. And this represents a second, utterly unanticipated blow to the enemy. So they do voting. We get more of that boxing visualization, this time with Momo also in boxing gear, with her stuffed cat as her second.
As her cut man. Cut me, Butchie! Meh.
Oh, boy. And yeah, it's like, you know, Momo's like, ah, keeping a finishing blow hidden to unleash when her opponent least expected it, under her guard and into her vitals. A vicious uppercut of flavor, a flash in the opponent's blind side. And we get voting, and Megumi loses. She loses 2-1. An votes for her, and the male judges didn't. Which actually, if you follow along with the way that Shokugeki no Soma's, oh, I'm horny from this food stuff works, they only were stripped down to their pants from the hidden flavor. They didn't get completely stripped. So there was a little bit just short there. And Hiswar explains that the commentary you made contained the tiniest hint of bitterness. The bitterness ever so slightly marred the delicate sweetness of the already perfectly balanced Shiroan paste. Perhaps had you added some pectin to the commentary, reducing it to the consistency of Baba. He says, like, you were kind of like a little bit of adjustment short. It doesn't quite all flow together. It's a good idea, but you didn't quite get it right. And he's, you know, kind of like actually trying to figure out, like, maybe if you did this, maybe if it... Actually, I don't really know how you could have done, that. And Une actually gets asked, hey, you know, you kind of voted for her. And she says, I don't fault your decision. It was absolutely correct, but I could not help but show my approval of her innovation and her incredible potential. Now, I'm going to share something with you guys that I prepared when I first read this chapter.
Okay.
I understand this, okay? This is, all right? It's like, Megumi went up against one of the central, against like what, the fifth?
The third seat right now.
Third seat.
She was fourth before, now it's the third seat.
Big. That's big thing. And she was a little bit of adjustment short of actually beating her, apparently. She came up with a good idea. And she, as we see at the end of the chapter, Momo actually acknowledges her and her potential. Now, there has to come a point eventually with Megumi where all this talk of, ah, she was impressive. That was a good showing. Good job. Good job there. Good showing in defeat. But that's going to stop. You can keep it up for a really long time as long as by the end, she breaks through and actually gets a big victory. You gotta do that eventually or else it's just a tease. And so, if this manga ends on this arc, which I am increasingly thinking it won't, I have prepared something. And if any of you, happen to know, Japanese, very fluent in it, then you can help me out with this because if the manga ends and Megumi doesn't get that big victory I'm talking about, I'm going to tweet Tsukuda Sensei with the message, Tsukuda Sensei, naze Megumi wa ima made ni okina shori o ete imasen deshita ka? Which means, Tsukuda Sensei, why didn't Megumi ever get a big win? And I'm going to keep on doing that until he answers me.
Wait, no, add, you rat fuck bastard at the end.
No.
That's why I don't send these tweets out.
I want to reply to this. So if that doesn't happen, I have this punched into Google Translate and saved on my computer to send to him. Okay? I will do this if Megumi doesn't get that big win. Cause I better fucking get that shit.
Here's the thing. So, Megumi's a great character. She started off kind of milquetoast, but then really grew to be someone you kind of admire and root for as this really supreme underdog. You know, in a series where the heroes are kind of up against stronger opponents all the time, Megumi has always felt like the biggest underdog. She was always kind of like one more straw away from being just expelled for not being talented enough. And we've come to know that she is actually that talented. She just sometimes stumbles when she first tries something and she's getting better. She just makes mistakes early on. And this training with, Shinomiya has been a big kind of experience where it was given several chapters of focus just showing the training they were doing together and why Shinomiya has come to respect her so much because he's seen her true potential. We get the impression that there is an immense amount of talent for, Megumi. You know, she is the only opponent who's lost in this tournament thus far who hasn't lost in a queen sweep. You know, she actually had a vote for her and it was meant to kind of signify she took the third seat to the absolute kind of brink and, you know, her opponent now respects her. Something she didn't do for several other members of even the Council of Ten. Like, she didn't respect Aizen. She called him Aizen-nyan or whatever fucking thing she did. So there's a lot there to say, like, Megumi has earned respect. But I think the issue is that Megumi and a large part of kind of the supporting cast of Soma have been pushed aside pretty frequently and often for showcasing Soma a lot more. Soma has been the one to have that match against Aizen early on. He was the kind of focus of a lot of the challenges during the tournament. He had the big match against Hayama. You know, he's had his challenges and ordeals, and Megumi and the other side characters just haven't gotten that. And Megumi, in general, just hasn't gotten much of anything. I think it's like her first real match since the Fall Classic, which was 3 years ago, 4 years ago at this point. So
not it's that long, but yeah.
It's a shame that this is the first fight she's had since then, and she's lost, if only because if there was something in between in the middle of this that really gave us like a satisfying kind of win for Megumi, it would be like, okay, like, this is a loss. It sucks, but it's important. Cause I mean, Soma lost and back in the Fall Classic, and that was a huge moment for him. That was meant to be kind of a defining thing of like, I got to keep working harder. Like, I got that close, but I was just a little off. That could be the same sort of thing for Megumi here, but it's hard to grasp that entirely when the last two significant matches he's had have been her losing just by a little to a supremely strong opponent. It, you know, as you said, we want to see her get that win, and I have confidence that we can see her get to that win. It's just definitely a perspective thing where we don't get much of Megumi, and when she does, it's that slow burn that just hasn't paid off yet.
I mean, when you look at it in a bubble, it does make sense, because when you think about it, it's like, okay, well, Momo was the one person in all of Central who, after the first round, okay, we hadn't seen her have a match before, so she's either going to lose in her very first one, or she's going to get a win to show that she's strong and then lose later on. And if she's the third ranked one, she kind of has to have that thing going for her. You know, Soma is probably going to lose this one because we've seen him, you know, show off how good he is before, because he beat Mimasaki even when Mimasaki was like seemingly perfectly mirroring him and going a step beyond. He showed that, no, actually his layout was just so perfect it couldn't be improved upon, and trying to do so was a mistake. We saw, you know, Aizon lost this time because like, okay, well, we've seen him have a match with Soma before, so we kind of know what he's about. So it did kind of make sense to have Momo progress onward because she was the one out of the three of them in this round that hadn't gotten to show her stuff before. I'm just saying that you can have a character who thinks that they're the underdog. They always fall just short. If that's the purpose and you have a planned payoff for it, you can't constantly tease it over and over again. This is the thing that happens in wrestling very distressingly often, where they'll be like, oh, what a great showing they just had against that, you know, future Hall of Famer, you know, that 10-time world champion. They were just this close to beating them. It's like, well, yeah, but you can be the guy who shows potential and eventually capitalize on that becoming a big deal, or you'll just be the guy who's remembered for always coming a little bit short and losing. There has to be a conclusion to that story. And there's going to be a point where everyone loses their patience and it's just like, well, that guy's never going to win. And so what's the point of thinking that they are? Why, what's the point of putting any hope in them?
I think part of this, too, also kind of calls back to some stuff we were really disappointed about in that first round. Rather than having the fifth seed at the time be knocked off in an off-screen match by fucking Megashima, wouldn't have been a little bit more satisfying for Megumi to have had that match against someone you could easily said, like, oh, well, they were just a new entry into the council and, you know, whatever. But just something to get her, they pick her up a win, essentially, and make it. Because remember, like, it's not as though we've even had anything to this point that really lifted her up. Like, it's not as though Megumi even got to this point because she was that good. She went against Rindo Senpai in the contest, and Rindo Senpai kind of let her and Takami go. Like, she kind of gave them an easy pass forward. Like, she acknowledged their skill, but she was a shitty, like, roadblock, essentially, if you remember, who just kind of let them pass.
I'm gonna make a prediction now.
Okay.
Which is, well, someone's gonna win this one. I think that's pretty apparent. And then that'll make it 4-3 in favor of the Rebels. We'll get another round of three. It'll be Erina, Takumi, and Ishiki. And Ishiki and Takumi will lose, and then it'll be Soma and Erina going up against Rindo and Tsukasa.
Who do you think goes up against Tsukasa in the end?
Soma.
I strongly disagree with that.
Okay.
I really hope, for the sake of this series and this arc, I think it is vitally important that Erina is the hero of this arc and beats Tsukasa. But we shall see. I could easily see it just going to Soma. I mean, his name's in the fucking title.
It's my show. Yeah. there's a little bit more to, I guess, to wrap up here. I mean, there's the tease of, you know, Soma's dish is done, so we're going to get his presented next chapter, presumably. But you know, the Sentra supporters celebrate. Megumi kind of puts on a strong front in front of Soma. She's like, oh, well, I lost. I wanted to work. I wanted to do it. And she's like, you know, apologizing to everyone. But when she gets up to Arena, she, you know, keeps on trying to do it. But eventually she just kind of, like, falters and she starts to cry. And Arena sees her cry. And you're like, oh, you can't show vulnerability just to her. You'll melt her heart.
I actually wish this had almost been given like a bigger page to like really showcase this. Cause I love this scene. You know, this is that thing that kind of like really built Ice Shield 21 up so well when you'd see like, Ryu after a loss and he like goes into the back and you just see him crying. You're just like, oh yeah, there are losers to fights too and things like that. And you know, it hurts them so much. It's important to kind of see this grief here because it's going to make their eventual victory so much sweeter, assuming they get one.
And then we get, you know, Momo, she walks up saying, you're not cute at all. Megumi Tadakoro.
At first, I misread this. I thought that was Megumi walking off, and I thought that was Arena saying that. I was like, fuck you, Arena! She's crying! I'm sorry she doesn't look fucking cute while she's crying, you sadistic bitch! Oh, never mind, it's Momo. Okay. Oh, it's a respect thing. Okay, I get it.
But, you know, it's a good way to kind of pull things all together because, you know, when they were starting up the round, they were like, Momo only gives nicknames to people and calls people cute things if she doesn't take them seriously and doesn't think they're a threat. So, yeah, she acknowledged her. Nice. Okay. Now we're going to go to Dr. Stone. Z equals...
Time to get stoned!
You just, like, doing it to try and shock me now? Like
I forgot. I, like, missed it. I was looking at the end of the page, and, yeah. Continue.
Z equals 36, Kinro and Ginro, which has a picture of Kinro and Ginro in, like, Yakuza suits, looking all badass. Well, Kinro looks badass, at least. Ginro looks kind of weird with his fucking pot collar. So last time Kinro with Suika's mask and the prescription lenses seemingly had defeated Magma, or at the very least had him ready to be defeated. Magma's being like, hey, isn't this a rules violation? He's like, and Kinro immediately is like, yeah, I guess I should check the rules. Yeah, you're right. And we were kind of calling this, but I really like the way that this plays out.
Oh, yeah.
Because... I mean, it's something, it's, you know, one of those things where it's like, yeah, it's something that we were kind of expecting, but not quite this way.
Yeah, because at first you'd argue, it's like, they established that the rules only if you interfere. I mean, they threw a helmet on him, it's not attacking someone, though.
Yeah, and he just immediately goes to the judge and says, well, Suika clearly threw this into the battle in order to assist me, and I donned it knowing that. So if I've violated the rules, then I'll accept the loss. You know, rules are rules. And Chrome and everyone else are like, oh, God, he's got to do things this way. But the judge says, like, well, she didn't attack anyone with the helmet. And so, you know, it's just part of a costume, so I don't see. And then Magma attacks him from behind and kills him, basically. Just smashes him over the head with his weapon and beats him. Now, I know that, Magma has, attempted murder with Gen before this point, and, his plan is to marry Ruri so that he can just wait for her to die, and take over the village, and he'll probably shove her off of a cliff if she doesn't die fast enough for him. But he broke Suika's helmet, that bastard!
That bastard! That'd be great.
How dare you!
She's like, I had a second one. Boop.
But fortunately, the Melina, I made sure not to, like, deal Kinro a fatal blow from this, so, he's alright.
You know what I'm super excited about for this series?
What's that?
I really want to see what kind of glasses they give fucking, Kinro after this. You know he's gonna get some.
He's gonna get horn-rimmed glasses, probably.
I'm just like, he's such this tough, stoic, badass dude. I want to see what kind of, like, glasses they give
him. You want him to get, like, the Melvin glasses from Sailor Moon? The weird.
Oh, like the spinny, like, fucking lens ones? Yeah, he's just like, hey, guys! I'm sorry, when I wear the glasses, I start talking like Jeff from fucking Shorty Jump.
If he doesn't have horn-rimmed glasses, I'm gonna be like, that just seems wrong, so. So, next up is Mantle versus Chrome. Now, everyone's got these, like, padded weapons, like, sticks with, like, a bunch of stuff around the stick to pad them out so you don't, you know, murder each other. Mantle's got two giant hand axes. Is he just considered, like, such a physically weak person that he's just allowed to enter this non-lethal fighting tournament with frickin' tomahawks?
Probably.
Because there doesn't seem to be padding on those. It's just rocks on sticks.
Well, I don't know if the other ones are supposed to have padding either. I think they just maybe like covered with like animal skin or something like that. And it's probably just like a rock on the inside or something like that.
I don't know.
Regardless, he's the only one that seems to use them, and he's such a weakling fucking loser. I guess they just don't care.
Yeah. So Senku tells Chrome, like, hey, you know, make sure that you drag this out, because we need to make sure the Kohaku comes back before our match, or else you'll have to forfeit. And Chrome's like, all right, I'll drag this out as long as I can. Some flailing worthlessly at each other. I love the expressions on their faces while they're fighting. So, yeah. But all of a sudden, Magma realizes, like, ah, yeah, that Chrome guy won't pose a problem. Even if he does last long enough to face me, I will slaughter him. But then he sees, like, oh, shit, Kohaku's right over there right now. Mantle, you lose right now! And immediately Mantle just, like, falls over. He's like, oh, no!
You got me.
So then they're, like, just starting at the third match. Kohaku's dashing across the bridge, but she doesn't make it in time. Senku is declared the winner by default, and Kohaku's eliminated for the tournament, so their backup option is gone. They've got to be able to find another way to defeat Magma. They've lost their two best fighters. And basically, they just have to rely on Ginro at this point. But, you know, Suika is there, and she apologizes to Kohaku, and she starts to explain, like, oh, I was kidnapped by Mantle. But Kohaku just grabs her in a big hug, and she says, it's enough to know that you haven't really drowned.
So it's very sweet. There's actually something from the previous panel, too, or previous couple pages, too, that I liked. On page 114, it's showing Kohaku coming back. I don't know why it's such a small detail, but I love just seeing the amount of, like, grime and kind of crust that they show are on Kohaku's fingers right there. Yeah. Really, like, I don't know. It's just something, I guess, you just don't see that kind of detail put in a whole lot to just show, like, how much, I guess, hard work and kind of, like, physical labor she's doing and things of that nature. Like, I guess it's just a cool feature to kind of see that drawn that intricately.
So everyone, you know, is like, okay, bodyguard Ginro, it's up to you. And Ginro's like, oh yeah, I'll be fine. Look, see, I put all the raw ingredients that you put into your science drink in here, and so I'm just going to guzzle them down right now. And it'll be super effective because they're raw. Yes, they'll be much more effective this way, right? And Chrome's like, it's gonna give you a bad stomach ache. No. And Sick is like,
shut up.
Let him go. And he like gets this mental image of himself being super ripped. Like he's suddenly the protagonist of Sunken Rock.
Yeah.
And, Ginro immediately fights does this guy have a name? His scarred opponent, and just charges headlong into him and smashes him in the guts and beats him. By God, what a spear!
I feel like they do name him at some point, like Akio or something like that.
They drop his name at some point, or at the very least, he would have been on that, you know, everyone in the village 2-page spread. But I'm pretty sure that Chrome's whole thing about he's going to give himself a nasty stomach ache is probably going to be the way that Ginro drops out of the tournament, unfortunately. Which means it's going to be down to one of our two nerd scientists to have to beat this giant, massive man. So, good luck fighting Gaston, guys.
Yeah. I love that.
No one fights like him.
I love that panel, though, that page of just like, it's placebo effect. Just let him think that he's awesome, because he will fucking do it. And it's just him, like, charging in like a fucking rug. Ah! Just murdering that dude in one page.
So, yeah, that's it for the chapter of Dr. Stone. Things are getting seemingly worse and worse for our heroes at this point. Kohaku's out. Ginro's out. They've got to rely on Ginro, they have to rely on Ginro's horrible delusions of himself. So there you go. And I guess the next match we're going to see is probably going to be Magma versus Chrome.
Yeah, this tournament's been moving. We went through the entire first round in basically a chapter, which I like. I like
all two chapters, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, we got the conclusion to each of the other fights in this chapter, basically. So I like a tournament moving with that kind of pace to it. So hopefully, you know, we can kind of move through this relatively quickly. And by the end of the year, we'll get to the end of this arc because I don't want tournaments to go too long or to get interrupted by a big bad guy villain.
Argo is the guy's name that Ginro just beat up, by the way.
All right. Let's move on then to We Never Learn, question 40, an elder faces her own choice with X.
So it's time to get learned, Chris.
Yeah! This is a, this is an Asumi Senpai story. So it starts with Yeaga and his two friends who I think I vaguely remember these guys from the very, very start.
At some point, but don't worry about it. It's cool friend and idiot friend, basically.
I couldn't even remember. I was like, are these new characters? I feel like we met them like at the first couple chapters.
They've hung out with Yeaga once or twice.
So he's basically at a bookstore with his friends. He's, of course, looking at study guides, and his one friend is like wants to buy an erotic magazine but is too embarrassed to take it up to the register. So
it says specifically erotic.
Yeah.
When erotic. An old woman makes the moves.
Yep. So Yeaga agrees to take it up using the secret study guide sandwich. Look, it doesn't matter.
How the cashier's going to look at everything.
First and foremost, here's the thing, guys. Cashier doesn't give a fuck what you're buying.
He doesn't care.
I've been a cashier and I've been on the other end buying just stuff that I was like, I'm gonna be judged for this. You learn you just can't give a fuck. I've been on the other end of it. I think the only time I was ever concerned about what someone was doing as like a store employee was when I was like, I'm pretty sure this guy is a drug addict who's going into our bathrooms to use drugs. But I still didn't fully care.
Okay, so you've got the rope, the basket, lotion,
this weird package of women's skin that we sell for some reason. That's strange.
Polaroid camera.
Even then, I'd still be like, man, this is going to be a great cosplay, right? So he's going to buy this, and he runs into Asumi Senpai at the register, and she's just like, oh, you're buying study guides too? Oh, hey, your sandwich is slipping, and she can see the erotic magazine in between then. So she's
teasing. That's a suggestive way of putting that, honestly.
I have to feel like it was known too. Your sandwich is slipping is definitely like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge in that. So they see him talking to, Asumi, his friends do, and they immediately are like, Yuega, it's illegal to hit on grade schoolers.
I love the way of putting that.
She's like, what? So he leaves with Asumi, and they're walking home, and she's still teasing him for this. She's like, you want to find a place to study together, you little horn dog? But then she runs into an old classmate of hers, who's like, oh, Sakuraba is her name. He's like, oh, I haven't seen you since graduation. How's life treating you?
And she's a
like,
really tall wide receiver.
Yes, she's really good.
She might be dating Sakuraba looking at that guy.
Yeah, he does kind of look like him. After post-character growth. This is a video. Exactly. Post-important haircut, yeah. He doesn't have the goatee, though, which is actually really important. But no, she says, like, yeah, things have been going great for me. This is me and my boyfriend. We're going to the coast. We're going to have a sleepover. We're going to all the photos we're going to take together. They're all online. And she's like, oh, what college did you end up at, Asumi? And she's like, oh, I'm a Ronin. Awkward silence. And she's like, nah, don't worry about it. Like,
I love the way that this plays out because she's just like, and Asumi's like, nah, don't worry about it.
Yeah. Like, she's
the
like,
the queen of awkward situations, masters that shit, knows it.
She immediately is just like, I'm Ronin. As the other person's just not talking to her. She's like, oh, sorry. She's like, no, it was my choice. Don't feel awkward about it. You know, there's nothing about it. And then she's like, oh, hey, who's this guy? You were referred to. Is this your boyfriend? She's like, nah, he's just a friend from cram school. As then the one fucking person in the world that she's lied to about this, her fucking head, just rides by the bicycle. And she's like, is what I say to people who ask, but really he's my boyfriend. I fucking love this shit. It's so goofy that the one person she has to keep that lie up for just happens to ride by then on a bicycle. And her dad, as he, you know, fucking rides by in his bicycle, he doesn't stay to chat or anything like that. He's just like, there's an awkwardness between those two. And as a father, I should investigate it. So Izumi and Uega are having lunch.
So creepy.
There's a moment when, you know, Uega's kind of thinking like, oh, I wonder if it was weird for her to, you know, see an old classmate who's doing all these things in college and, you know, she's in this place, but she seems pretty cool and collected about it. So, it works. She starts getting, actually, there's also another small bit here too, where Uega's like, all right, finish that answer. Let me check my test and everything like that. And, you know, Izumi's like, actually, you know, I see you always checking your time after you finish a, you know, question. You may want to get into the habit of double checking your work, because when you're in an actual exam, you won't have an answer guide nearby to double check to make sure your answers are right. So, you know, it's helpful, because otherwise an exam can kind of overwhelm you because you don't know if your answers are right otherwise and things like that. So a good habit to kind of get in. And, he's like, yes, I'll take that to heart. She's like, good. You're a good learner, Pornmeister.
That is such a great title.
The Pornmeister.
That is such an awesome turn of phrase. That seems like something that you would like encounter in a weird parody game. It's like, you must purchase this from the Pornmeister.
At first, I thought it was one of those times where the speech bubble was just too small. So when I saw porn, I was like, oh, it's just like, porn or something. Like it was a word that got cut off or something like that. But I was like, oh, no, it actually is just Pornmeister. But that's when Izumi gets a text from her dad, who's just like, how are things going with you and Uega these days? I don't see a picture of the two of you ever together. So she's like, ah, fuck, we gotta appease this old guy, you know. So they start taking photos together, and he just keeps
saying... Well, he says, because they're like, we don't do that kind of thing. We're not that kind of couple. And he's like, that seems suspicious. Don't tell me this is all some kind of ruse. And they're like, God damn it.
So they start taking photos together, and he's just like, don't you think you two are awkwardly far apart? Oh, you're still kind of far. Where are those romantic vibes?
This guy is so creepy, because it's like, okay, it's like, well, you seem like you're just kind of hanging out. I'll buy that to begin with. But then they're doing stuff like, they make a little heart with their hands together. It's like, okay, they could have easily picked that. They drink from the same cup. Okay, I can see that. Then she sits on his lap. It's like, all right, that'd be enough to convince anyone.
Yeah, they basically...
No, we must do a lap photo of him laying his head in her lap.
Hey, he's gotta know.
I swear to God, it's like, this guy is not gonna be, like, convinced that they're actually in a relationship unless he gets to, like, film them consummating their wedding or something. This guy's so creepy.
He's there watching the Prima Nocta rites. He's just like, okay, I guess you two really do love each other. Goodbye!
Hold on a second, I'm not convinced. You never went down on her.
Yeah, he's like, I want to make sure that my little girl's getting hers too.
Oh my God, Dad, leave!
It's like, how is this not the dad with the restrainer? Poor Ogata's dad's just like, I hope you love me.
Actually, I think instead Yuiga's like, this is really weird. And Asui's like, get back down there, you perv.
Yeah, get back down there, Pornmeister.
That's like her pet name for him.
That's a nickname. If fucking Boruto showed up, she's like, Boruto? He's like, Pornmeister? That's a fucking nickname. So yeah, they go through those. They go through these series of, like, increasingly more kind of romantic photos. And finally, her dad sends back, like, I'm sorry for doubting you, an ideal couple, but be sure to balance romance and studying. Good luck. And she's like, finally, all right, we're done. Sorry about all that. And she kind of notes how it was actually Sakuraba who saved the day, because all those photos she took were essentially replicas of Sakuraba's photos with her boyfriend that she had posted online. And she just imitated all the poses. And she's like, you know, thanks for doing that with me. And she mentioned that it's also really helpful, because the truth was seen, Sakuraba got her feeling down that she was getting left behind. But because of this kind of experience with Uega, she got to kind of feel a little bit about having some summer memories and fun of her own. And it felt really great to have that. And, you know, Uega's a little stunned, so she's like, you want to take one more shot? She goes in to kiss him, and he's just like, wait a minute, senpai. And she's about to send that photo to her dad again, like a photo of her about to fucking mac on him. And she's just like, well, you tricked me. And she's like, well, I thought you're into that stuff. When an older woman makes the moves, referring to the magazine that he bought earlier that had that on the cover, he's like, I told you that wasn't mine.
I love Asumi's whole thing with, like, she's so comfortable with herself that she can tease Yuiga like this and not feel uncomfortable herself. I also, on that page before she does that, I really like the picture of her smiling. Mm-hmm. It seems like a really vulnerable, emotional, like, she's, like, letting him see her like this, kind of letting the guard down because she trusts him. And also, it's just a really cute little picture of her. I feel like if these two were, like, if she weren't, like, the fifth girl introduced as a potential love interest for Yuiga, then it would be like, oh, I could actually see these two kind of getting together. They have a nice dynamic, and they really get along well. And she seems like she would have the type of personality to actually initiate things if she were interested, because Yuiga sure as hell ain't going to do that, a little wuss. So.
Yeah. It's nice having somebody in the harem group or whatever that's got, like, initiative on things. And I love that she just has this kind of regularly teasing, you know, sort of playful personality. And it doesn't ever come off as, like, creepy or just, like, fan service-y or things like that. It's not like she's like, everyone, we're at the pool, take off your clothes. It's not like that. Like, it's just like she's Urza, where it's just like, everybody, strip naked.
Like, or, like,
just,
Marika, or, for
yeah,
example.
She just has this personality where she's just very, like, she doesn't have many hang-ups about these things. She's pretty open about this sort of stuff and just likes being teasing and stuff like that. I just think it's a fun thing. I do really like her as, a member of this group, and I like this chapter for getting to see a little bit more of her. I thought it was a sweet sort of sentiment of her being like, yeah, I didn't say anything. Like, Yuiga didn't pick up on the signs that, like, oh, after meeting her friend, she really wasn't bothered by not having those experiences. But at the end, she's like, yeah, I really was, and it was nice that, even though it wasn't intentional, these things we got together kind of made me feel like I had a great adventure over the summer instead of just studying the entire time. It's a very sweet sentiment.
I do sometimes worry after we get an Asumi chapter that it's going to end up with her suddenly developing feelings for Yuiga and losing that confident, comfortable part of herself. So
I feel it's inevitable she will get feelings for him, but
just so long as she doesn't turn into, like, how do I tell him? Which, I don't know. I mean, if she, like, develops the feelings and she quickly gets over and she tells him and he's not interested, that's fine. Just don't turn her into I have feelings for Yuiga, but I can't tell him for another 300 chapters or something like that. Because that would just ruin this part of her character that I really like.
I think one of the most interesting things they could do is if she, you know, if she develops feelings for him, to pursue them. And to work through them. Because I think they are two people who work well together, but I think this is one of those relationships that would be, like, destined to be rather short-lived. Generally tends to be how teenage romances go anyway. But I feel like that would be actually a really good learning experience for Yuiga to go through a real relationship and have it end in a mature way.
Mm-hmm.
Than to just continue working on the idea of, like, Asumi's just another one of the girls with feelings who doesn't know how to say them.
Yeah. All right. With that out of the way, we are going to move on to the Promised Neverland, Chapter 64.
Which I believe you guys can pre-order Volume 1 now at Viz. I didn't realize the volumes were about to come out.
Anyway, Chapter 64 could have been me. The song, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't that an NSYNC song? It could have been me.
No, it's going to be me.
Well, that's all I knew. I'm surprised I knew that one. My family was much more of a Backstreet family, so I know all those classics.
Hey, we were not, Team Backstreet.
I'm not kidding you. My sister and mom both love the Backstreet Boys, both had a very distinct favorite and least favorite of the Backstreet Boys, and hated NSYNC. My sister
they knew
not,
what their names were?
Brian, Howie, AJ, Nick, and Kevin. My mom liked, my mom liked Brian, my sister liked Kevin, my sister used to make fun, my mom used to make fun of my sister because Kevin had really big eyebrows, but didn't matter. They both hated Howie though. They thought Howie was just like too feminine, like they didn't think he was very like attractive, he just looked too wussy and things like that. AJ was the bad boy, by the way, and of course Nick Carter, Aaron Carter's, you know, older brother. Nick, I know these things. I grew up, they were around me all the time. I know deep tracks of the Backstreet Boys. You know how many fucking times I heard I Want It That Way?
Not enough. Never enough.
It is true.
I mean, I don't want to hear you say.
Yeah. By the way,
you are my fire. This, one desire.
This is an odd thing here. I just want to note this.
The one that leads to your heart.
I watched a couple Backstreet Boys videos a couple months back, just like on a curiosity train. I forgot how like a lot of the Backstreet Boys at the time, like the videos, had to have all the Backstreet Boys doing their own thing. Like they all had like their own, like there was the one where they were haunted house monsters.
Yeah.
And like all of them had their own.
Backstreet's Back.
All Right. Yeah. Whatever the exact title of it is. And they all had like their own thing. So like one of them was like a Phantom of the Opera and one of them was like a fucking mummy. Then there was one like in space and they had to have them doing all these weird things. So like one of them was just like in a fucking galactic, like fucking Tron match and shit like that. I was like, this is so weird where they were just like, Nick's got to have his own thing. He can't also be a space pilot. That's what fucking Kevin's doing. Stupid.
Anyway.
Not tangent, but I had to get it out.
So, at the end of the last chapter of The Promised Neverland, Emma addressed the no-name geezer and said that she would help him, which catches him off guard. And basically she says, hey, you know, we don't really need to be against each other. We shouldn't be plotting against each other and opposing each other. We're both escapees. We should be able to understand each other. We should be able to cooperate. So let's just do that, you know? Let's try and understand each other, and then we can help each other. And Ray's like, what are you doing, Emma? He doesn't have baby memories. We can't trust him.
For a moment, I was like, is there a JFK character in this manga? It's like, Emma, or, Emma. What are we doing? Don't talk to him, Emma. Get out of Emma.
The no-name guy says, you know, it's like, what the hell are you talking about? Who do you think you are? And when he opens his mouth to shout at her, he suddenly looks a lot older to me. Do you feel that same way? Like the way that like his face is drawn with the lines on it?
There's definitely a couple shots where I think it's just meant to be like he's gritted himself and you see like veins, but also it just looks like you almost see like wrinkles or things like that. Maybe it's just dirt kind of crusts on the face after a while. Definitely,
I guess that's possible. But yeah, he says like, we're not going to talk. So, you know, shut up, get lost. And it was like, no!
No!
I love the panel of her doing that. The face she makes.
You're like, ah, kids!
So she says, look, I know you might want to kill me, but I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to leave you alone. So, come on, we're not going to solve anything by just avoiding this. Look, you were in pain, weren't you? You and your group were a family, too, and you loved your friends. And you lost them. You were frustrated. You were full of hate. You suffered. For years and years, you were alone, repeating every day in agony and despair. The guy's like, well, how would you know anything about that? And Emma says, well, I don't know. I can just imagine it. And I can't say I understand what you went through from losing all of your friends, but I do get it because we're the same. The old you and me right now, my family and your friends. And that's why it's tough for you to look at us. Because they remind him of his family.
Indeed.
And, yeah. So, like, okay. And she says, we're not the ones you want to erase from your mind. It was the old you. You might be able to distract yourself momentarily by getting rid of us, but in the end, it won't change anything. You'll still be suffering. So, let's change that. And the guy's like, how? Nothing can be done about it. No matter how much I regret it, I can't change the past and my dead friends won't return. Distraction's good enough. As long as you all disappear. Your face makes me sick. You are just like me when I was younger. I don't think I could overcome any despair. That I could work hard because I have my friends. And you are the same as me. You can't save anyone. That's the hellish reality that can't be changed. So what can you do? But Emma gets a big determined look in her eyes and says, we can survive together. Let's live. I'm returning to Gracefield within 2 years. I'm going to get the younger ones we left behind. I'm going to release all the others and take everyone to the human world. And you should come with us to the human world. Let's go see the world your friends wanted to see. And she brings up Norman and talks about him for a little bit, talking about, hey, you know, we lost him. We can't bring him back. I had to let him go, but he left me to handle the escape, And if it hurts, even if it hurts, I have to keep moving forward for him. I'm going to go see the world that he wanted to see and live in the world he wanted to live in. And that's what you need to move forward to for the sake of your friends who die so that you could carry on their will. Your friends wouldn't want you to give up like this, and deep down, you don't want to either. And the old guy has a flashback, which even omits his own name from it. There's a point where someone yells at him to run, and his name gets erased. So, yeah. But, he remembers all the times that people were, running into danger for him or dying and telling him to live on, telling him to keep on going. And he thinks to himself, because of them, I was able to survive. I was able to escape that place. They let me live. Me alone. For what? And, he thinks to himself, come on, I'll just distract myself from the pain. I've got to get rid of them. I've got to throw them in despair. I've decided I'm going to kill this one. I'm going to kill Antenne at Goldie Pond. And he starts to, grit himself and get ready to do it. But he instead just says, you've got to go back. You can't go to Goldie Pond. That place isn't good. It's dangerous. Leave now, because tomorrow morning they're going to. But before he can finish, Ray notices something, yells at Emma to get down. But what looks like a wire of some sort suddenly snags her and yanks her away. And everything blacks out. The next thing that happens is Emma's waking up. She was taken somewhere, apparently to the Netherlands.
Yeah,
look at them windmills.
It looks like she was taken to the fucking, to the Netherlands or to that world of fucking chocolate that Homer imagined when he was talking to the Germans.
Or like that happy place that Big Mom grew up in or something like that.
I don't know what the fuck just happened. I don't know where Emma is at this point. My first thought was like, is this another one of the farms? Did they throw her into another farm? But this seems like a weird design for a farm. I have no idea. None whatsoever. But it's exciting. I like the idea that she really did kind of get through to this guy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of sad seeing him go through this flashback. Or even though we're just getting moments of it, you can still see various different scenes, almost, it looks like. Someone who looks like they're on the ground dying. Somebody who looks like they're clearly trying to, go as I defend us. Or somebody who's just like, go leave us behind. Or, just those attitudes of him kind of seeing the various kids that he's known. And even those brief glimpses, we can kind of relate to that, to what we know of the Gracefield kids. And knowing what kind of challenges they went through. So, we get some context for him and seeing Emma finally get through to him. And him kind of having this turn of heart, no change of heart. It's like, it's compelling. And it's really exciting to think okay, Emma got taken somewhere. It's now the mission of Nameless Geezer and Ray to go save her, presumably. I don't know. Really exciting.
We'll probably be following Emma, from this point forward, because she tends to be the point of view character for most of the series. Mm-hmm. So it could be that she'll be discovering what the hell is in this strange land and what's going on while off panel, Ray and the old man are trying to do something about it, but who knows?
I'm sorry, in that panel, I wish it would almost go down of turn back immediately, look away, and Emma's just like, what's happening? Emma! What, Ray? I have bad memories! That was what he was warning her about, and she gets wrapped up in rope and taken. She's like, Emma, you fuck!
Emma, get down!
What? Why am I ducking?
Because you don't have baby memories.
Ha ha ha. Oh, she's gone.
Where'd she go? Oh, I hope she didn't go to the windmill place. Only uncool people live there.
That's where losers go. Windmills are so 2018. It's not 2017! I know, they're not going to be cool until next year. Oh my god, it's 2018, Emma, I'm coming to save you.
And Kitty right now. I do really like this chapter. I like the way that this conversation unfolds, because it's not, Emma just saying a bunch of magic words basically to break through the guy. You see her, just gradually breaking through to him. At first, he just doesn't want to talk. He tries to keep her at a distance. And then, when she breaks through, he starts to actually go with her path of thinking. And then eventually it gets to a point where around halfway through where he's almost begging her to tell him something that she needs to hear. And then, at the end, he finally just kind of breaks, opens up. I am curious what the hell's going to happen next, and I'm really, really happy with this chapter.
Yeah.
All right. We don't have Seven Deadly Sins, and we also don't have One Piece this week. So that means we're going to finish up with Black Clover. All right. So last time, Zoro revealed himself as actually being part of the Black Bulls. He's going to be with part of the Royal Knights, along with Asta and Noelle and Luck and a whole bunch of other people. You know, of course. And we got page 134, Dream, which is, I guess, it's a dream from Raya's perspective, Raya being one of the members of the Midnight Sun.
I think this is a dream from Leash's perspective, and he's just shared it with the other members of the Midnight Sun.
It's possible, I guess, but they call him Raya's. People are addressing him as Raya from his perspective.
Possibly. I just know that the one wife says Leash belongs to me, or belongs to everyone, and nobody at the table looks like Leash, per se. Like, the person sitting next to her doesn't...
The person at the end of the flashback is Leash. The guy who is getting married with their baby.
I guess it is. I don't know. It just doesn't look very much like it to me. Maybe it's just the perspective thing.
It's because his eyes aren't fucked up.
True.
But yeah, apparently what's going on is that at this moment in the flashback, Leash, an elf, is going to marry a human. And they're going to have a half-elf baby with really disappointing racial traits.
Hey!
Until fourth edition, then they'll be good.
Yeah, I was going to say, half-elves have been dope for the past two editions.
3.5, though, they suck. Just like, you get low-light vision.
I'm like, woohoo!
Do I get to change any of my stats? No. Do I get that bonus feat humans get? No.
What do you need feats for?
What do I get? You get bonuses on listen checks.
That might come in handy. You might be able to hear yourself about to be killed.
You can do a lot of the stuff that elves can, but worse. You get to be ostracized from two societies.
Yeah, both races will hate you.
Depending on the setting. But this is just a quick little flashback that doesn't really tie into anything else that goes on in the chapter. But I guess a little bit of insight into might have caused Leash's family and stuff to be horribly murdered and turn him into a vindictive asshole. Anyway, we go back to where Zoro and company are. No, it's no longer Asta and company. It's Zoro and company. He's the best character. Zoro is kind of taunting Asta, being like, that's right, I'm part of the Black Bulls, and I've actually been part of the group longer than you have, secretly. And Asta's like, oh, that's no fair. Have another rainbow stink bug. Throws it onto his head, and Asta's like, ah, it stinks! Actually, you get used to it after a little bit. And Zoro's like, what's with the shrimp? He's being boring. And I'm like, you're right, Zoro. Asta is being boring. What the hell is with these two chapters of him? God, her name is so hard to remember. I'm sorry. Maria Leona announces that all of the members of the Royal Knights are going to have special Royal Knight robes that have high resistance to magic attacks. So she's like, all right, come and get one and change into it. And Asta's like, Royal Knight robes? That sounds cool. Oh, but I've got this Black Bulls robe. Well, I guess if it works, everything's fine. Yeah, he's dull and emotionless. That's his thing. It's because he's so freaked out over the whole thing that Yuna did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is fine.
This is very
Rill's funny. There. Fuck Rill.
Oh, but Rill's doing the same thing, Nick. He's also traumatized. Because Rill's important and cool, too!
Well, they even have the exact same thing happen because Rill's, like, snow vice captain girl and Noelle are both trying to, like, get them to snap out of it. And it's like...
Yeah, he has the exact same thing because Rill has to be cool, too, Nick. Everyone love Rill, right?
Never have I been happier in this entire series to see Yuno show up. Because Yuno shows up and he's like, hey, Asta, if you're not into this, you can just go home. Looks like I'm the one who's going to be Wizard King. And then Asta's like, no, it's going to be me!
Fuck this series. Fuck this series. This is hot garbage! This is one of the worst fucking things I've ever seen. That's all it takes. Asta has been doing his bullshit for two chapters. All it takes to shake him out of it is just Yuna walks up and is like, I'm the Wizard King. And that's it. That's all their relationship is boiled down to. A fucking empty fucking notion that one of them will have to become the Wizard King. There's no personality between them. There's nothing. Yuno is a blank slate that just exists to be one peg further along in the fucking board game than Asta. And that's enough for him to wake up out of this fucking stupid ass little, like, blue screen of death that he's in to be like, I'm all motivated again. There's nothing. There's no emotion behind it. It doesn't say anything like, oh, if you're just going to cry there and go home, then I guess you'll never be better than me, or hit upon any kind of nerve that relates to Asta's personality or any kind of character trait of his. He just says some empty fucking notion, and that's all it takes for Asta to be like, I guess I'm powered up again. And that's it. It's fucking garbage. These two have the worst rivalry relationship in Jump history.
It's kind of like if Asta has a crush on Yuno, but Yuno is constantly, you know, like rejecting him, spurning him, or indicating that he has no romantic interest in Asta, and Asta gets hurt and is upset about it. But then Yuno shows like the barest interest in him, and he's immediately back to like, oh, I love Yuno. Because there's like characters like that in stories for comedy purposes. Like, that's it. I'm going to burn all my pictures. I'm over him for good. Hey, how you doing? Oh, I love him! It's like that.
Yeah.
And it's...
It's just frustrating.
It makes Asta considerably less admirable as a hero when he's like that. When all it takes in order to get him motivated is for Yuno to be a dick to him.
Well, it's like, look. This thing exists. This is a very common tactic in these sorts of series where the hero feels like they're at their lowest. And then usually like the anti-hero or the rival might say something like, you know, you can usually see, like, I'm sure there's a scene like this where in Dragon Ball, Goku maybe wasn't sure of himself, but Vegeta might say something like, is that what the king of all Saiyans would do? Or something like, just the villain, like, the kind of anti-rival character will say something to kind of pick the hero back up and get them to go out there. It's a common tactic. I'm not saying it's, like, it's stupid for him to be like, oh, he insulted him, that's why he get better. It's that there's no heart whatsoever to this situation. Asta had that very sad moment where he's watching the fight happen from a hospital bed, crying because he can't get out there, and he is just mortified by it. Then spends the following two chapters afterwards being almost comatose / brain dead and kind of just wandering through life without any of the same zeal or enthusiasm or anything else like that. He has none of it. Then Yuno shows up, and in three panels, everything's fixed. And he says nothing that actually connects to Asta as a character. He just says, what, are you going to just sit here and space out? If you're not into this, just go home and I'll be the Wizard King. And it's like, fine. Like, it just, there's nothing to that at all.
I think that it was probably a miscalculation to have all this whole freakout thing happen during what's really just been a couple of comedy chapters, because that development could have really actually played into some strong moments for Asta playing forward from that. And I don't know if it's just a matter of, you know, wanting to keep the pace, just move on to the next thing, and not having time to just kind of collect yourself for that, or what. But Asta wasn't in any scenes after that point where that could have played, I guess. It would have clashed too much with the jokey tone going on around him.
If
you're going to have him have that freak out, if you're going to have him have that freak out, though, why... Or if rather, if you're not going to follow up on it, why would you have him have that freak out in the first place? Because all you've done is have that big dramatic moment for him lead into a couple of silly jokes.
Or save it. Like, there's no reason that the first time Asta interacts with Yuno, it has to be over. Like, you could just save it. They don't talk to each other here. Maybe Yuno notices something and just kind of goes on without it. It's not like Asta's, like, literally comatose. You could assume he'd still go on the mission, just maybe his confidence is a little bit shattered. And then some point during the mission, maybe Asta isn't, like, doesn't jump to fight the way he used to. And let that be the moment when Yuno does this sort of thing and kind of calls him out on it. And that's what kind of spurs Asta to keep going. Like, put some kind of emotion into it besides just Asta doesn't want to, like, he has his personality for a hot moment and then just loses it all. And then it's a joke and then Yuno shows up and is like, get your shit together. And that's it. It's just everything in this chapter annoyed the shit out of me. Like, having Rill suddenly have, like, oh, he has the same thing, too. It's like, go fuck yourself. What is with Rill suddenly being pushed as the coolest character in this series? I don't get it. Like, none of this stuff just... I don't know. I feel like the worst parts of that tournament are all being emphasized, and the best parts of it have just been buried.
Now it's time for the part of the chapter that Nick hates the most. These robes look stupid.
Well, this actually bothered the shit out of me, too. So they get the robes, and they're like, here are your robes, everybody. Our robes look dorky, but whatever. But then everyone, like, asked us, like, why is mine so short? And they're like, we ran out of fabric. I'm like, then why did you fucking make, like, I know it's just a joke, but why the fuck did you make the robes if you were like, well, this one just doesn't have enough fucking fabric on it. Like, isn't this kingdom richest? Like, how did you just run out of fabric? And then wouldn't you just not, like, it just seems like such a weird joke to be like, fuck you, Asta. Everything works against you.
Number one, order some more. Number two, don't have so many royal knights. Look at those no-name NPC assholes in the back. Why the fuck do they have to come along? God, these robes look so stupid. A couple people look okay in them. Like, I think that, you know, when he first shows up in the robe, he looks pretty good, I think. It's an alright design for him. Asta's short robe looks stupid. Zora looks stupid in his. So many of them is just like freaking draped over them. They look like they're wearing like knockoff Akatsuki cloaks. They look like a freaking choir.
Yeah, I was gonna say, they look like a bad choir group.
A really bad choir.
You know what?
I understand the reason why they look this way and why they're different from the mantles of the Magic Knight Squares. Like, it's basically their armor, so it should cover more of their body. In which case, why does Asta have to...
You know what would have redeemed this? If they had made, if they were like, we ran out of enough fabric for yours, but they still made a really tiny version of the suit for fucking Sylph, I would have laughed my ass off at that point. But they didn't do that.
Oh, God. Then they're like, oh, and also these guys are participating. Shirin, TM, and Cobb Portaport. I vaguely remember them. Also, Nozel is here because he was appointed by the king.
And cool.
Let's
have him in there. It would make sense for him to be in there. And this is another chance for Noelle to get development with her and her family. They got one cool part of the tournament and incorporated it into this Magic Knight group. I guess two, if you count Zerks.
And had it make sense too, because like Mary Leona is like, why are you here, Nozel? And Nozel's like, shut up. The king ordered it.
He's like, fuck off. That's why.
Real is like, Nozel, why are you showing up as if it's only natural? You didn't even take the test. That's not fair. And Nozel's like,
Mario Leona didn't take the test either, and she's fucking leaning them, you stupid fuck!
And Nozel's like, why did you take the test when you're a captain?
I don't know why. Real is making me so irrationally angry. Like, I've seen her yelling at a fucking comic book character, but I cannot stand this kid.
He's with his like fucking stupid hair, his stupid face, and his stupid paintbrush.
And every fucking thing he says sounds annoying and bitchy. Like, God, you're just the worst.
And now it's time for the Wacky Roommate Show. He's an anti-technology hypocrite, and he's a Painty McDear dude. It's Real and Boruto.
I'm like, I've never hoped for a comet to hit a television so as hard as this. I mean, I got pretty close with fucking Young Sheldon, but this was so much, this is so much more.
Well, and the king shows up at this moment and chimes in and is like, the extreme strength of a royal captain is bound to be necessary. After all, he's royal! Royal! It's like, okay, yeah, the real king, the king meddled in stuff. Therefore, he put a frickin' noble on the team and had him put in a position of power. All right, makes sense. And now we get to have a potential dynamic going on between Nozel and Noel. So, all right. Good job. I love how this douchebag, idiot, weird, full of himself king makes all these wonderful decisions. He has led to only good things for us to read so far. Marielle Leona takes charge and she says, all right, we're going to win this. And if there are any idiots on this team who can't make it happen, I'm going to kill them before we head to the enemy stronghold. All right, kill Rill. Thank you.
It'd be great if, like, Rill has a question. Can I wipe my nose on your robe? It just punches him in the face.
All right. this very last part of the chapter really bothers me. Because she says, the hideout of the Eye of the Midnight Sun is in a floating dungeon in the Gravito Stones, a strong magic region. Presumably the Gravito Stones means gravity doesn't work in this region as well, because it's a super dense magic area and gravity gets fucked up, so rocks float around. A floating dungeon? Are you fucking for a hideout?
They're really inconspicuous.
You might as well just put a fucking neon sign like, this is the secret dungeon. Who puts a dungeon in a floating rock, by the way, of the Midnight Sun? There's a castle floating out in the middle of the goddamn sky.
That'd be great if they put a sign on it on the outside that said, no bad guys here. And everyone was like, is that where the bad guys? Well, there can't be anyone here. The sign says no bad guys in there. All right, let's head on our way.
Everyone's like, all right, rumors tell us that this is a secret hideout of the Eye of the Midnight Sun. And Asen's like, I don't know, guys. It says there's no bad guys here.
Let's go home. Obviously, their tale was wrong.
And Yuno's like, this is why I will be the Wizard King, Asen.
Oh.
Oh. We were doing so well. Oh.
Look, it's not the worst chapter in the world.
It's not chapter of Black Clover, even. It's just like hitting all of the buttons that have come up of late. So.
Yeah.
Oh. And we did get that big group spread of the Royal Knights that I was saying we were gonna get. It's a weird assortment of people that are gonna be involved in all of this. Okay. That's it for Black Clover and for the recap portion of the manga recap. Let's close things off by saying what we liked about this week, Chris. What were our favorite series? What was our favorite character?
So my favorite series this week, I'm going to give to My Hero Academia. Dr. Stone was a really close one. And actually, I liked Food Wars a lot, despite a lot of people saying they really didn't like what happened to Megumi. But I think In the Vacuum was a good chapter for it. But I think My Hero Academia, I love a good villain group. And giving the villain group a time to show like a huge kind of like success on their end is really important. I like building Shigaraki's group to be intimidating and well-developed, and like seeing like what Mr. Compress's powers can do in action. Like, it's just all really awesome. I liked it.
I think that we got a few very good chapters this week, but I think that we're probably going to be echoes of each other for this. I also have My Hero Academia. I really, really liked the way that the villain society stood out. Really kind of put their foot down and be like, yeah, we're the main villains. So we're going to just take fucking charge. And I could not believe the absolute brutality with which they treated Chisaki. Damn. So that's that. My MVP for this week is Emma. It was a very big character moment for her, breaking through to the no-name guy. And I really like the way that she went about it. Didn't just, you know, like deliver a speech. She had a conversation with him, and she really kind of understood what the guy was going through, or understood what it would have been like to go through it, and managed to really tap into that. And I really did like the fact that although it happened suddenly, she did break through to the guy. And I like how there was this twist where it looked like it was going to be a battle of wits between the three of them, and Ray was still all ready to go for that, and Emma's just like, no, heart will save the day. And she was apparently right.
Yeah, I think that's an extremely important, Emma is mine as well, and I think it's extremely important for her to, you know, really showcase that kind of core trait to her that, you know, in the group of three, the thing that Emma always kind of stood out for the most was having this very optimistic kind of view of others and keeping that optimism. I think it's very important that, you know, when she meets somebody who she feels has been hurt and who she can relate to, then in the end, it wasn't about to see if they could overcome this guy. It was a battle for her to connect with him and to appeal to him. And I think that was a very sweet way to kind of go about that.
I also do want to just deliver a quick note that, if not for that, I think that I would have probably gone with, Kanata for,
yeah. Wait.
So, but, that is gonna do it, guys.
What the audience pick? Do we still do the audience one?
We hold the poll, but I haven't been checking it lately, so.
Oh, okay.
It was My Hero Academia with 50% of the vote, so there you go.
Okay, I was just checking. I was like, oh, do we still do that or not?
I've just been neglecting it, but all the audience results are there. So, all right, so that is going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap. We are going to return next week, and hopefully Nick will finally be done with JoJo Part 4. All right. Thank you guys for joining us here on smashcast.tv/RealOT and twitch.tv/RealOT, where we record Weekly Manga Recap Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Normally, sometimes when you need to change up either the recording time or place, and to stay updated on that stuff, you can follow us on Twitter. He is at RealOT and I'm at Y Ruler of Time, and the official podcast Twitter account is at WMR Podcast. Follow that one specifically to get updates on all the stuff that we've got coming out, including our bonus stuff. Speaking of which, if you want to support us financially, you can do it on patreon.com/weeklymangarecap. People who support us get all sorts of bonus goodies, including if you become a champion level subscriber, you get to get the bonus podcast every single month. And this week we had an As Explained by Manga special that, led to much frustration and confusion.
It was on Kingdom Hearts to explain. It was Kingdom Hearts As Explained by Manga. And I had to explain to Nick everything about Xehanort.
And special guest Annalise. It wasn't quite as bad as I thought it was going to be. I managed to put everything together by the end, but there was definitely some weird, like, what? moments.
I had to explain that there's four different people inside of Sora. There's a lot of people in Sora's heart.
It's a big heart. It's like, he's not that guy. He's another guy.
No, he just looks exactly like
him.
Because remember, his heart's inside of Sora. It has been, ever since Sora was a baby.
So it's his nobody? No, it's pretending to be his nobody.
they pretend they don't have emotions, but they do. It's bad writing, I don't know.
So the heartless come from hearts and the nobodies come from bodies? Yes.
It makes sense.
Anyway. If you want to check out past episodes of Weekly Manga Recap, you can do that by checking out weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. Also, our YouTube channel. Subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you do any of those things, be sure to leave a comment, rating, and help us to defeat the woodworkers and become kings of the hobby section on iTunes. Special thanks to everyone who has given us your support. We really appreciate it. And that also goes to the people who help make our podcast what it is, including Steve Mann, our talk artist. You can check out his work on a number of different places. Someone showed me that he had made a giant boobs pic, and I don't mean like big boobs, I mean like crushing people beneath them boobs picture recently. So be forewarned that he does do some NSFW stuff, but if you want to just check out the tire cars too, he's got all of those put up on his Patreon.
For a moment, I thought you were about to continue that he did a giant boobs picture of me. Of you, and I was nice. Like, you're like, there's a giant picture, a giant boob picture of Nick crushing Bleach. I was like, that's awesome.
I'd be okay with that. And, of course, Infamous Planet. So I think that's everything.
Yeah, I think that's it. Guys, if you're listening to this, obviously if you're listening to this on YouTube, it's already passed. But for those of you who listen live, I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving and all that. Make sure you eat plenty of food. And if you're not in the U.S., I guess, I don't know. Enjoy Wednesday. I don't know. Do whatever you do on Wednesdays that aren't special.
It's Thanksgiving's on Thursday, Chris.
Thursday, whatever. What day did I say?
Wednesday.
Oh, well, then you're listening to Weekly Manga Recap, so you already know what you're going to be doing. Hey! Yeah, it all works together. Oh, I'm falling apart, Nick.